On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Past the hour, welcome to Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go to find access to the chat room. I'm popping in there right now. It's free. It's easy. Just sign right up and wander right in. You'll also find our new shiny, spiffy new pop-out media player. Enjoy that as much and as often as you wish. There's also a rotating choice or selection of news from around the world available at the website so that you can go and make the Horn a sort of one-stop shop for looking for news stuff, kind of, yeah. And, of course, the PayPal button is also there. It's via the PayPal button and the associated traditional U.S. Postal Service mail address that we managed to keep all of this on air. We have found ourselves in the deepest hole of the young month of March thus far. We are we need to raise about $250 this evening. Thanks very much going out to Greg. Greg dropped me a note along with helping out some a little bit ago, and he said, "Dear Reverend Bob, I believe an evil spirit has enveloped me in my home. All winter, I've had to set the thermostat to 74 degrees just to keep warm. At night, it becomes very dark. I'm not sure." And such are those moments when we fear that we have been touched by a demon. In this case, a winter demon, a weather demon. I'm hoping that we can accomplish some sort of virtual online exorcism for Greg so that maybe he can move his thermostat again. Maybe it'll be like the vernal equinox miracle or something like that. So thanks very much for helping out, Greg. So we need to raise $250 this evening. Thank you very kindly. Randy noting it loud and clear on iTunes on my Mac, Bob. Thank you. And, of course, remember, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. And if you need to be out and about, remember, you can take the Horn with you anywhere you go now. There's wireless internet service on your tablet device, your smart device, what have you. We recommend the apps from TuneIn Radio and Stitcher, with the gentle reminder that any ads you may hear for, say, like Exxon, on either of those has nothing to do whatsoever with what we are doing here at the Horn, and we don't get paid. That's part of the deal. If we want them to carry us, we have to let them run ads, even if it's from Exxon. Ew. Right. So it is. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday here on the Horn, and there's a whole bunch of stuff to discuss on this Thorn in the Side Thursday. Oh, mercy sakes, a bunch of stuff. Sometimes, not that anybody here has been blessed with the gift of prophecy or anything, wandering around in a frayed old purple robe with appliqued moons and stars on it and a magic eight ball with a cracked face that always says, answer hazy, ask again later. Not that any of that is true, but I found this a little bit interesting. Lo and behold, after a brief mention of apparently a silly movie coming to movie screens, probably near you, in the near future, like the 28th of the month or something, this Russell Crowe vehicle, a film called Noah. Now, let's remember the purpose of Thorn in the Side Thursday. those things that make you go, ew.
Yeah.
This is one of them. So lo and behold, it pops up in conversation, and then bang, there it is—a story today, out of a Hollywood industry kind of publication called The Wrap. That's Wrap with a W. In which it turns out that the director of the movie Noah, starring Russell Crowe, found out after the fact that Paramount Pictures had appended a disclaimer to the movie. Why? Because the weird little snake-handling, floor-rolling, tongue-speaking, strychnine-swigging fundies are having a hissy about the movie Noah. Which I kind of find it, oh well. Why are they having a hissy? Oh, dear. Apparently, director Aronofsky... Darren Aronofsky only found out after it had become a fait accompli that Paramount is adding a religious disclaimer to the film, and they're putting the disclaimer on all the marketing materials. Why? Because the National religious broadcasters got their maiden forms in a bunch. Over the content of the film. The national religious broadcasters now have the power to bring the Paramount studio to its knees. This is fundy appeasement. So apparently the disclaimers based on what Paramount said, this film is inspired by the story of Noah. While artistic license has been taken, we believe that this film is true to the essence, values, and integrity of a story that is a cornerstone of faith for millions of people worldwide. The biblical story of Noah can be found in the book of Genesis.
What, Edith?
Okay, Genesis chapter 6. I think we're going to have to go and examine. And yeah, there's important stuff going on in the world today, but this just pisses me off. Oh, let's see. And it came to pass, things were always coming to pass back there in Genesis, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, 6 times 12 is 72, and daughters were born unto them. Huh? What? Stop it. This is not prayer meeting Wednesday, but just stop it. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, that daughters were born unto them. Because before then there hadn't been any daughters, it was all just Cains and Abels. And they are, what? How are they having their traditional family values, marriages between one man and one woman, if they hadn't had daughters yet? The sons of God, that's a curious phrase, isn't it, saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. That was back before they understood calendars, or wheelbarrows, or why it rained, or that the Earth revolves around the sun, not vice versa. So you go, yada, 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 verse 6, verse 7, God gets pissed off. He's going to kill everybody on the planet because, you know, he's like that. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. And he had three sons. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth was also corrupt before God. The earth was filled with violence. Yada, yada, yada. Remember, this is all bogarted from... There is not an original word in Genesis. It was all bogarted from somewhere else. So, you know, go and build an ark, yada, yada, yada. Okay. So the ark gets built, right? And the floodwaters come, and the unicorn, poor little unicorns die. And right. It's in what happens after that things get interesting. Because that's the part where Noah's sons get daddy liquored up, and then Noah's sons have sex with daddy. Ew. I mean, really. Ew. So, the fact that the National Religious Broadcasters Association, Coven, Claven, what have you, is upset about, and why? Well, according to the rap, prominent Christian activists and scholars, really Christian activists and scholars, that's hilarious, out there marching about a movie while the people that their savior said they should be taken care of keep starving and freezing to death and burning in fires. And yes, prominent Christian activists and scholars have expressed concern about Aronofsky's retelling of one of the most famous stories and the most sacred text in the Western world from its inception. Huh? Most sacred text in the Western world from its inception? I'm sorry. No, the Iliad and the Odyssey were quite equally sacred in that cult. Yes. That book has not been that sacred for that long. The criticism began more than a year ago when an older version of the script leaked. Imagine that, a movie about Noah and something leaked. After reading a copy, Brian Godawa, no really, who works over there at that place that was run by that Breitbart guy who is mercifully dead. He's having a hissy. Godawa is. If you were expecting a biblically faithful retelling of the story of the greatest mariner in history, huh? And a tale of redemption and obedience to God, you'd be sorely disappointed. Noah paints the primeval world of Genesis 6 as scorched arid desert, dry, cracked earth, and a gray, gloomy sky that gives no rain, and all this caused by man's disrespect for the environment. In short, an anachronistic doomsday scenario of ancient global warming. Oh, dear, that can't be good. Oh, so it goes on and on and on. The fundies are pissed off. But this is my favorite part. Ken Ham. Oh, wait, back up. The National Religious Broadcasters board member Phil Cook was interviewed by the RAP, and he said that they had to demand, the religious broadcasters making demands of a movie theater, near a movie studio. Gotta love it. Taliban much? Theocracy often? He said they had to have the disclaimer because the story as portrayed in the movie Noah is historically inaccurate. Huh? Huh? How can something that isn't historical be historically inaccurate? Excuse me? It's a myth. It's not even an original myth invented by the people who wrote it down. They got it from somewhere else and repackaged it. Oh, God. It's historically inaccurate. I mean, everybody knows. I mean, for instance, their CGI arc is clearly made of oak, when we all know that history tells us that it was made of gopher wood. You know, for pity's sakes. Okay, so that's bad enough. Now, Ken Ham, noted Australian science denier and hustler who created the Answers in Genesis Creationism Museum. Hoo-wee. He said, the film's not at all faithful to the biblical account in Genesis. It's a Hollywood con. It's trying to lure unsuspecting Jews and Christians to an unbiblical production. I mean, Noah's family only consists of his wife, three sons, and one daughter-in-law, contrary to the Bible. It appears as if every species was crammed in the ark instead of just the kinds of animals, thus mocking the ark account in the same way secularists do today. Noah does not have a relationship with God, but rather with circumstances and his deadly visions of the flood. And the ark lands on a cliff next to a beach. Because Ken Ham knows where the ark landed. We discussed this. The Godawa Crete doesn't like the way Russell Crowe portrays Noah. Noah's a kind of rural shaman and vegan hippie-like gatherer of herbs. Noah explains that his family tries to study and heal the world whenever possible, like a kind of environmentalist scientist. Remember, this guy writes for White Fart. Yeah. This is being pitched as history in the United States of America, and there just aren't enough of us normal people to go, shut the up. There's no way this is history. Tim from L.A., what's the big stink about Noah, let alone the entire Old Testament? I mean, unless you're Jewish, the death and resurrection of Jeebus the zombie helped create the new covenant, and what is old is now new. So the big stink about Noah shouldn't be a big deal. Also, if these right-wing fundies read their book of myth, the bolt thrower created a rainbow. Is the sky spook gay? To try to make a promise that he would never flood the earth again. So by making a big stink, wouldn't that piss off Jeebus' dad after he murdered all those poor people? Maybe these Christians need to shut their damn mouths up? I pray, I yearn for the day. And, of course, Marty tells me, Qatar, Bahrain, the UAE, all of them are banning Noah from even being screened in their countries, with Egypt, Jordan, and Kuwait expected to follow suit. Okay. Yeah, I had a feeling that line would get to Dr. John. The greatest mariner in history? So the movie Noah is a John Paul Jones biopic? Or about the guy that shot the albatross? There, two candidates for the greatest mariner in history, neither of which is the drunken dude in the tent. Hey, son, come here. Bring me another goat skin full of that Merlot. No, son, really, get away. I don't want to do that. May have to go out and borrow another cup of vomit. It just goes on like that. And of course, getting away from that foolishness. You know all about, by now, the sleazy business with what Daryl Issa did to Elijah Cummings in a House Oversight Committee hearing yesterday. It cut off his mic, did everything but spit on him. Really showed himself to be the sleazy freak that we know him to be. Well, it's not sitting too well to see one of the elder statesmen of the Congress thus so poorly treated. And the Congressional Black Caucus has written a letter to John Boehner, who does not have the spine to do much of anything at all, demanding that Daryl Issa, unindicted co-conspirator, near felon, that Daryl Issa, and I hold the people in his district personally responsible for sending him to the Congress in the first place. I mean, the pickle barrel's got to be pretty well damn nigh empty when the best you can do is Daryl Issa. But no, Daryl Issa abused Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland quite thoroughly. I mean, it really was. It was shameful. I'm sure most of you have seen it, heard it by now. Representative Marsha Fudge wrote a letter to John Boehner demanding that he reprimand Daryl Issa and take away the chairmanship of the Oversight Committee, which would, in fact, be a fine idea. But he ain't gonna. Boehner said, I think he was within his rights to do what he did. Daryl Issa is his chairman. He's been an effective chairman, and I support him. Yeah, like you'd expect anything different from John Boehner. Marsha Fudge then retorted, "The abuse of authority and misuse of the congressional privileges afforded them are an affront to the expectations of the American public. Congressman Daryl Issa of California abused his authority and therefore must be reprimanded to ensure the dignity of the House of Representatives is preserved." I agree in principle with Representative Fudge. It's about as tawdry a display of raw aggression, maybe passive aggression. I don't know quite how we're defining that these days, to see what Issa did. But I have to take issue with a couple of Marsha Fudge's premises. And one is that the American people expect something else, something better from the Congress. The latest polling, as it has for, 4 years now, shows that the American public doesn't think much at all of Congress and has no real expectations of Congress beyond expecting the rapig lickens to continue to wallow in their own filth as they have been doing. And then Marsha Fudge's assertion that Issa must be reprimanded to ensure the dignity of the House of Representatives is preserved. To preserve something, the thing being preserved must first exist. There is no dignity in the majority, the jackbooted majority in the House of Representatives. They have no dignity. They have their front feet in the trough, and the only thing they're interested in is seeing how quickly they can get the back feet into the trough, too. And, of course, we've seen this before. John Conyers. Why is it always a dark-skinned member of the Congress who's getting abused by some pale member of the Republican Party? Because John Conyers had this done to him several years back. I remember, back during the dark and miserable days of the George W. Bush misadministration. No, that wasn't a misadministration. That was a maladministration. There's a difference. But how can we ensure dignity in a House of Representatives that has none? How can you preserve that which does not exist? if there was any dignity, if the American people could expect anything of the Congress of the United States, yes, Darrell Issa would be stripped of his chairmanship and he would be publicly censured for his I mean, imagine that. Calling a hearing and not allowing anything except his own cherry-picked inquiry. The witness is excused. Yeah, after I ask a couple of questions, I said the witness is excused. You need to shut up. Shut up! Go away, I'm baiting. Yeah. Then, of course, that whole interlude didn't sit too well, any too well with Sergi via email noting, dignity? Preserve the dignity of the House of Representatives? Sorry, Representative Fudge, but that train left the station years ago. Yes, it did. Oh, it was, Irish Dave, a strongly worded missive. Irish Dave, now wait just a gall darn minute. Going back to the whole Noah thing. The non-kosher ham is from the land down under and has yet to answer the question, did Noah have only two kangaroos on his big boat? Well, no. He had kinds of animals. Not animals themselves. Kinds of animals. So maybe he didn't have... Maybe he didn't have two roos. He may have had a pair of wallabies. Wait a minute. They'd have to evolve into kangaroos then, wouldn't they? And they went hoppity, hoppity, hippity, hoppity, all the way from Ararat up over to Australia. Go figure. No, going back real quick to... The ISA issue. Bless her heart, one of my favorite members of Congress, Representative Louise Slaughter of New York, one of the original co-sponsors and one of the first people to jump on board with the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, H.R. 526. She had a little something to say about the shenanigans as put forth by Darrell Issa. Thanks very much to Shorty from L.A. for sending this in. Check out Louise Slaughter.
Introduce the terrific ranking member of, the Rules Committee. Louise Slaughter has been a champion of your side.
Thank you so much. Good morning. I'm delighted to be here with my friends this morning. We have sort of reached the boiling point. And I want to say to you, because none of you look particularly interested in what we're doing up here, that this is really an important piece of work we're talking about here today, because democracy is under threat. What has happened in this place week after week in the House of Representatives is nothing short of legislative malpractice. The Congress of the United States used to be the gold standard of legislatures. And we went by Jefferson's manuals year after year after year, Congress after Congress, doing what we could in making this the most incredible country on earth. And now what are we doing? I want to give you numbers. I'm going to be brief and talk about it. What happened yesterday to Ranking Member Cummings, this is the first time I think that ranking members have gotten together to complain. What happened was so outrageous, so demeaning, so unjudicial, so awful in every respect, that we just absolutely have reached the boiling point. I have been up for it. You all, if you pay attention at all to rules, which is a pretty powerful committee, you know that I've been telling you for years here, the last 2 years anyway, that every week we are here, the estimated cost, please write this down, the estimated cost of running the House of Representatives for 1 week is $24 million. Okay? Now, the first 33 times that we voted to kill the health care bill, it took 80 hours of legislative work and cost of about $48 million. So it's gone way beyond that now. What happened, you've heard about the IRS, was that all the money that they have been spent for nothing. Because we don't do legislation that is intended to ever become law in this land, and I think secretly many of them are glad for that, but because we come here, 435 of us are brought here every week to do what basically amounts to a press release. Please pay some attention to that. The public needs to know. If you have a House of Representatives that talks about nothing but cost, nothing but spending, that will take away food stamps, that thinks it's immoral to help with unemployment insurance, but is throwing money away by the buckets full on a useless legislative process here that goes nowhere, and they don't want it to. Now, last election, 1.4 million people more voted Democrat than Republican for the House of Representatives. When we get all the closed bills that we get from the Rules Committee, I want you to realize what that means. That means that half the population in the United States, their representatives, are not going to have amendments. Whatever they may want on the bill, whatever they may want to do, is not going to be considered. You call that democracy? Please, have, for goodness sake, think about what is happening here. We're going to come back next week, and we're going to take some old bills out of Judiciary Committee, John, and try again to humiliate in whatever way they can the President of the United States, to try to insinuate that the man is a lawbreaker. I mean, we have sunk to such a low when it comes to legislation. Yesterday, and I want every last one of you to have a piece of it, we put in the record 50 pieces of legislation crying out for attention. But we do the same thing over and over and over again. It's almost gotten to the point where we could stay home and somebody could just go in a room and put repeat on the record player and have it all over again. It is full of sound and fury, meaning nothing. And they want it that way. It is to stimulate their base, whatever it is. But for goodness sake, every week it's let's destroy the EPA. And I know you've seen this. All regulation is bad, they say. So that all the things that we worked for all these years so that you could breathe clean air, drink clean water, eat safe food, all that means absolutely nothing. And so that's why we're here today. We have got to get the public aroused that the public knows what is happening here. Nothing. Nothing. And for reasons that I really cannot understand, all of you who are so brilliant, and I read you every day and never take my eyes off the news. I haven't even been able to read a book in 2 years because I have to watch what you guys are doing all the time. Never say a word about it. Not a thing. You may say, most unproductive Congress in history, and off you go on to another direction. Think what the money that is being wasted here week after week to make a political statement is costing us, not just in terms of infrastructure, education, health care, but what it's costing to our self-respect and the way we look to the rest of the people in this world. And so I'm so happy to be here today. I feel really liberated somewhat today that we're saying, we pay attention here. We need everybody to know exactly what's going on here. We're doing our part. We all show up. We go through the motions. But Jefferson's manual is absolutely not a part of what we're doing here. And Abraham Lincoln's adage can be proved again once more. You can fool some of the people all of the time. A strong press paying attention to the government helps us not to be doing that. Thank you very much.
Wow. I think we may dare say that Louise Slaughter gets it. Doesn't surprise me in the least that she does. But I think if you've been in Congress for a while, you must have certain organizing principles about what that Congress is and what it should be doing. And maybe it's taken a few years for some of these folks to realize, as we have asserted time after time on this program, that this country is engaged in a cold civil war. I coined that phrase because I couldn't come up with a different way of making clear. Did you hear Louise Slaughter say, "We're getting nothing done, and they want it that way"?
she's got about one more step to take before she actually realizes, I think, and this is not a criticism, this is praise, before she actually realizes that the Republican majority in the House of Representatives are anti-American, anti-government, anti-United States insurgents. This is an insurgency. And I'm really, really grateful to Shorty in L.A. for sending this along, because this tells me that maybe now that the light is beginning to go on and they realize that these are not just people with a somewhat philosophical difference from them, but that rather the Republican majority in the House of Representatives are trying to dismantle the United States of America piece by piece by piece. Maybe this awakening can bear some kind of fruit. And Representative Slaughter is absolutely correct when she says that the press are largely falling down on the job. You reckon that's going to be on the front page of it? No. Hell, it won't even make the front page of Louise Slaughter's hometown newspaper. Our representative, Louise Slaughter, delivers scathing critique of Republicans trying to break the United States into a million tiny pieces. They won't it? No. On the other hand, what will be there? You know. Darlene, with a note, wow. Impressive. Thanks for playing this. Louise Slaughter is hitting it home. Yes. And we damned well need a few more people to do that. We need that light to go on for more members of the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives. Because until they understand the nature of their enemy, you know, this is not their dear, you know, that dear friend BS, these are not, the other side are not dear friends or good friends. These are people who are trying to destroy this country as we understand it. They despise gay people. They despise people of color. They despise the poor. They despise women. Hell, they despise veterans. The only people that the Republican majority in the House of Representatives has any respect for are the millionaires and billionaires. And if it goes on very much longer, and there's a distinct possibility that it will, this country will come apart. A few more years of hacking away at food stamps, a few more years of hacking away at social safety net programs, this country will be devolved into something none of us even wants to ponder. Dr. John just sent along a photo that kind of goes with all of this. You know that CPAC is going on. That's the annual Clavern conclave of the right-wingiest of the right-wing in this country. Lunacy. This photograph is of the room in which they were holding their minority outreach panel. CPAC opened today. And while on radio it is not particularly easy to talk about photographs, I think we can do a pretty good job with this. Remember, minority vote outreach panel. In other words, a panel about figuring out how to get people of color and people who are ordinarily not part of the Republican base to lose their minds and go and vote for Republicans. This is a humongous ballroom. That is empty. I'd say not even 10% of the chairs are filled out of what must be 1,000 chairs. If there were 50 people there, it would be surprising to me. I mean, it just hold on. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, maybe 50. Dr. John noting, I figure there must have been a panel at the same time called How to Slut Shame Working Mothers that really drew off the potential audience for minority outreach vote panel. Yeah. Thorns in the side. Thorns in the side. And something to talk about perhaps in a little bit later. Yea, verily, glory, hallelujah, West Virginia has a chemical storage tank bill that has finally passed the House of Delegates. The legislative session will come to an end, mercifully, on Saturday. The Senate has passed one storage tank bill. The House has passed another. They have to be reconciled in committee, and it has to be fully passed by both houses come, by midnight Saturday. Wow. Isn't that just stunning? We will. We'll talk some more about that later, if you would like to. I should go ahead and mention the phone lines are open, 304-658-3333, if you want to join in the conversation. Let's go to the Skype line. Haven't heard from Jeff in a while. Hey, Jeff.
Hello, Bob. How are you?
I'm a little bit better because I think we saw 55 degrees today.
Well, you know, it's been interesting. I've been in and out of. I've had some health problems, but I've been in and out of hospitals, and all of a sudden I meet my doctor, and he walks around like a pompous ass, by the way, and he's a very capable guy. But I went into the emergency room a couple of times, and there's these people working on me, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and. The hospital, I'm in a very poor area in this warm part of the world. And I walked into the hospital, and within 5 minutes, I'm in the main room. And within an hour, they had me feeling better. Within an hour and a half, I was home. That includes the paperwork. And then I go see my pompous-ass doctor, who's, as I say, he's one of the tops in the United States. And I said, you know, how much more do you think you are worth than the guy in the orderly in the room? I said, how much more are you worth? I mean, and then you look around and you say, what's going on? I mean, I'm hearing I'm listening to the news today, and I hear what's going on in Australia because of the Japanese disaster, and the woman on the air was talking about, well, we need our jobs because we have to mine uranium. And then I listened to that's why nobody concerns themselves. And then I hear about mountaintop removal, and I hear about fracking, and I listen to this woman who's actually from New York, who you just had on the recording, and you're saying, well, the main media is not going to cover this, and the main media hasn't covered anything since 1970s. I mean, they really were bought and sold right after the Vietnam War, so don't expect anything to happen from that. Now, the problem is, it's pretty damn discouraging. And if we keep on, I know we have to look at the problems, but at what point in time do we say we're doing something wrong? And I'm not an advocate, by the way. I think if you pick up arms against our government, like some people say, or we vote in the right people, and then we fight amongst ourselves, again, how much more? How many more times do we want to keep on changing regimes? When you see what's going on, I mean, there is something radically, systemically wrong, and I think that we're doing a horrendous disservice I consider ourselves a free media. You are running a free media service for your knocking the people volunteering and the people who are doing the staff and on your unpaid staff and on your chat room, and they're all sending in all kinds of stuff, and we're rallying everybody up. But is that really going to change anything? Is that even if we?
It's got a Jeff. It's got a better chance of changing something than sitting around doing nothing.
No, oh no, you don't ever ask me. Don't no. I agree. I look at my fat wealthy friends, and they're out there playing golf, and I can't worry about this. Let the kids worry about this. And I listen to that, and I literally go off the wall. I mean, they've had the best possible life you could ask for. Someone between 60 and 80 years of age, you couldn't get a better quality of life that we have. And now, and I watch these poor sons on guns in the hospital. These people have education. They're working their asses off just to pay off their student loans, and they'll never do it, by the way. And then you look at on both sides of the aisle. I'm looking the wealth, the absolutely unmitigated, literally unmitigated wealth, and they sit back fat and happy, and they can. And as you say, we have a thousand seats in the House, and there may be 12, 15 people sitting there. There's something really, really wrong.
Well, remember though, Jeff, that's CPAC. They have about as much interest in minority outreach as a hog has in Easter Sunday bonnets.
No, I concur. But the idea is we need, and I think if we could put forth, and as you brought out, a Republican, which was Nixon, brought forth a living wage. But it can't be a living wage just for the U.S. If we can get some kind of a living wage,
I'm in principled agreement with you, Jeff. And one of the things that we did to make sure that income inequality got broader across in a global scope were all of these godforsaken free trade agreements, where good-paying jobs could be taken from places where the jobs were good-paying and sent to sweatshops and slave labor camps in places like Bangladesh and China.
Granted. Why was that done, though? Because it was a more beneficial thing for our
ownership
our
class, yeah,
to make a living. I mean, that's to pay off the stock. I had a guy with me for the past 2 months. And he's supposed to be, I hate the government, he sat in one room and watched a computer. He wouldn't even walk out and look at the birds. So busy watching the stock market. I mean, it was actually sickening. And I said, what are you doing, man? I mean, it's a beautiful, the birds are, it's beautiful out there. Well, it's warm here, but I got this chart I designed. And I had another guy over there, you know, some other fellow that I knew for years, and he supported some, a great guy, not a bad guy. So, Bill, how about helping with the, maybe we can do something with this. Maybe we can throw some money into it. Maybe we can sort of put some ideas together. Maybe we can get together a whole bunch of more radio groups together to try to talk about how we can fix the system. That's not my job. I'm too old for this bullshit. I mean, this is outrageous.
Just a straight-up punt then, right?
Oh, man, it is just so... And by the way, when I listen to... I listen to a lot of programming, including right wing, and they're basically saying we got to get rid of those wealthy people because they're killing our kids. They're saying the same shit. They're saying it a different way.
Well, and maybe that points towards something. I was reading earlier today a new article by John Nichols over at the The Nation. I don't know if you're familiar with John Nichols.
Yeah, sure, I'm familiar with The Nation.
Well, he's a tremendous writer and a hell of a speaker. But he said he had a sit down with Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, and I wouldn't say earth shaking, but it was a substantial revelation insofar as Senator Sanders said, "Look, I'm open to running for president in 2016." And he said, among other things, that he didn't know if he would run as an independent or as a Democrat. But one of the things he said is that he's been doing a lot of traveling in a lot of places you wouldn't expect a Bernie Sanders to go. He's been to South Carolina. He's been down talking to folks in Alabama. And dovetailing with what you just said, Jeff, he mentioned the fact that he is looking at the idea of trying to do some coalition building between progressives who want meaningful change and I got to admit, I cringed, teabaggers.
Well, I want to bring something out. I have a friend of mine who's a teabagger. And when I talk with this guy, I tell him, you know something, you're not a teabagger, you're a progressive. He gets so mad at me. I said, you think progressively. I said, that makes you a progressive. No, I said, you just got the label.
Oh, Jesus. You lost him, though, Jeff, because he's been told for three, four years now by the Glenn Beckerhead that progressives want to eat babies and murder Jesus and cause communism and global Islamo-Marxist fascism. And you might as well have said something about mama.
No, I actually did. I actually said, look, your mother wasn't paid to bring you up. I said, but you were brought up reasonably well. Now, she didn't get paid for that. So why can't human beings accept the fact that education is a majorly important thing? And he said, well, you believe in global warming? I said, whether I do or not, education will solve that problem.
You're much better at this than I am, Jeff, because if someone asks me if I believe in global warming, I say, no, I don't believe in global warming. The global climate catastrophe is not something to believe in or not believe in. It's not like whether or not, you believe in an elephant-headed God or Jesus on the cross. Global climate change is a damn fact. So, no, I don't believe in global warming. I know global warming to be factual.
Well, the fact of the matter is I spent my whole life being a union rep, and if I said something like that, that's the end of that conversation. I'm sorry, I have to be a little...
No, I understand that. That's just why I'm no good at this.
No, the point I'm making is that we are... I don't want to come up... I'm not smart enough to come up with an answer, but I can tell you something that... By the way, hold it before I go any further. Bernie Sanders, Dennis Kucinich... There are maybe that I'm not aware of, but those are the best people so far left in Congress, and I don't think.
And Kucinich, of course, is gone.
No, of course, but so you.
But you know, Louise Slaughter is another one. Unfortunately, she's getting up in years. I hope she's got the stamina to stay at it for quite some time. We just had a note from Glenn a moment ago along the lines of what I was saying about. Well, Glenn said. Louise Slaughter is my representative, and you were right. There was no big news about Louise today. And by the way, I think she's the best, and she is. She's a tremendous member of the. And it's people like Louise Slaughter and Bernie Sanders that give me pause when you hear somebody say, "Well, we just need term limits on everybody, and then we'll throw all the bums out and get new." Right, because if you threw out, say, Louis Gohmert from Texas's 1st District, I'm sure that there's a progressive just waiting there to take his place, and the people are going to elect him or her.
But they also, look, the Koch brothers, the amount of money that is out there on the right side, by the way, if it was on the right side to actually help do good, I would say, wow, it doesn't really matter what side you're on. But these guys, it's psychopathic behavior. It, it, there's, I mean, this is all, there's no reason for more and more money, but the more money they have, it's basically set up for power and control. So if it's for power and control, wait a second. Now, somebody I also had another major conversation with with rights of collectivism versus whatever, you know, collectivism versus individualists. And I said, you know, you have the right, all human beings, I believe, have the right to be be an individualist. The problem with being an individualist, if it trumps on my clean, as Slaughter said, my clean air, clean water, and clean calories, if it trumps on that and poisons my kids and me and my friends and family, we got a huge problem. So what I'm saying,
yeah, I'm sure somewhere in the past you've heard that old saw, your rights end where my nose begins. I think along the lines of what you're describing here, Jeff, we maybe need to reevaluate that and rephrase it. Your rights end where my clean air begins. Your rights end where my clean water begins.
Well, exactly. Well, and also where you pull my education away. I think if we educate people properly, your clean water will auto sort of show up. You can talk about your population intelligently. You can talk about your clean calories intelligently. But education is the key issue here. And when you're dumbing people down, giving them misinformation, you're never going to be able to change the system the way we see it now. And I think the way this economic system has a grip around the whole world, I can't see any way of changing it unless we do something so subtle. I had an imam on one of my programs the other day, and I wanted to clarify that what this guy believes. I wanted to bring out the fact that he's not really, he explained himself. I'm not going to go into detail on that, but it was very interesting to listen to this fellow speak. He's a younger guy. And I've met him many, many years ago, and now he's got his imam thing. But maybe it should be time when we start thinking about a different way we can approach this instead of the same old. Is there any other way we can think about how we?
Well, I mean, that's what I'm trying to do, Jeff, by talking in terms of a cold civil war. And talking in terms of Republicans, not as fellow Americans, but and teabaggers and birthers and deathers and tenthers and assorted booger eaters with too, but talking about them as insurgents who are actively trying to destroy this country.
The trouble is that,
and that's not hyperbole on my part. I believe that all the way down to my toenail clippings.
Oh, I have no doubt in my mind you do. I understand something. I do listen to you. I have no doubt about it. What I'm saying is I don't believe, what I do believe is that the problem doesn't lie, it doesn't lie with the Republicans or Democrats. It lies within the economic system. And believe me, I really try to find myself, I'm looking to be wrong so I can just drop this thing and go to something else. But I can't. I mean, all of a sudden, I'm not wrong. The more I look at it, it's the what's going on. And the one who hit the thing nail on the head was Clinton. He said, it's about the economy, stupid. And when he said that, I never really picked up on it. But now that I see what's going on, he was being, with tongue in cheek, he was actually right on the button.
Well, no, that was a big part of the 1992 campaign.
Right.
And it was the economy. But the problem is, that's the same Bill Clinton who a few years later signs off on the elimination of Glass-Steagall.
That's right. And he also put into place, actually, the NAFTA program. I mean, he was the one who signed off on that deal. I know that I'm a union rep. I was a union rep for many, many years. And when he signed off on that, I never forget the outrage that these guys held. I mean, and they were, and I'm not saying they had no right, but the reality is we are
I guess by way of answering your question of politics versus economics, my response would be something along these lines. When it is politics that makes sure that millions of Americans cannot access unemployment compensation going on 3 months now. When it is politics that causes people who were barely getting $3 a day to eat on with SNAP benefits in the first place to lose them altogether. When it is politics that insists that the Environmental Protection Agency is somehow destroying America, then the solution has to have at least an aspect that is political in nature.
Oh, sure, I agree. But what controls the political process is the basic essence of the economic system.
Well, money in politics, sure. Legalized bribery.
Well, you have the minute you have a system as we have now, you have, in fact, a corrupt currency, a corrupt people. The currency itself is not corrupt, it's the people corrupted. But the reality is that how, and this was my argument all week with my guest who was here who does stocks. He's saying, we just got to get on the gold standard. I said, okay. I'll put you on the gold standard. Now, who's going to control the gold? Who's going to have the gold when you change the standard over? It's going to be the same crap. And he couldn't see that. I said, what I'm suggesting is that...
No. This guy's a stock trader and he wants to go on the gold standard? Is he also like an LSD addict?
Well, he
I mean, I'm not trying to be mean to your guest or anything, but that's lunacy.
I understand what you're saying, but my point is that if I hang out with all the people who agree with me, well, that's great. I got a rah-rah group. I want to hear all the which of course I consider myself maybe someone who likes to get beat up, but anyway. I gotta listen to all the arguments. I've gotta deal with them. If I don't, the more arguments I get about it, the more arguments I get. So my answer to this guy was, okay, I believe that everyone should have individual rights. And I'm gonna give you one more. I believe that everyone should actually have the right to make as much money as they can. And the guy said, really? I said, yeah. I said, here's the rub though. If you want to make $1 million and you're an ambitious person, I think we need those guys. But you can't ever stop any human being in the world. If they work from 3 hours to 15 hours a week, they will always have their education, food, and shelter. Then let your free market take off.
That's a reexamination of what we laughingly refer to these days as the social contract and the elements thereof.
Well, the other friend of mine, the hard progressive friend of mine who was here, screaming at the top of his lungs, worse than me, but I've known this guy for 30 years. He said to me, well, you don't need a measurement. What you just need is to get the whole world to understand that human beings have human rights. I said, you're entirely right, but in the language that we have in this world, they require some kind of something that says what human rights. Where do you draw that line? So he said, well, we just have to get that message out. I said, no, first we have to draw the line. Every human being for 3 to 15 hours of labor, with their intellect, will have education, food, and shelter. If they choose, and by the way, when you say food, that is clean air, clean water, clean calories. If you mess those things up, that's a penalization. You lose. You can't do that. But once you've got that understood, that the whole world agrees to it. So if I go to Bangladesh or if I go to China, and they say to the somebody in China, you're going to work for a teeny, teeny amount that you can't sustain yourself on, the person in China says, wait a minute, the world gave me a measurement that said if I work 3 to 15 hours, you have to give me, according to the world, according to my human, inalienable, or whatever rights you want to call it, you have to give me education, food, and shelter. Then I can work for you. But the whole world has to agree. That's part of our GDP or GNP. And all of a sudden, I've got the Tea Party guy agreeing with me more than the progressive guy, which I found absolutely amazing.
That is not an unknown occurrence, Jeff. But the question remains. For instance, we were talking a couple of nights ago about Victoria Jackson, who says that Barack Obama is a Muslim Marxist communist in the White House.
Right.
And she doesn't want children to be learning about how the human body works because Jesus. And so, and she is an exemplar of teabaggerism. So what do we offer up to a Victoria Jackson in compromise so that we can go forward and heal this nation?
If we
look at Victoria Jackson and say, okay, if we agree with you that Barack Obama is actually Barry Sotoro, who was born in Kenya and isn't really a citizen and is a Kenyan Muslim Marxist usurper, will you agree with us that a woman has the right to control the workings of her own body? You think she's going to say yes?
No, of course not. I mean, I'm not. We can't be naive about it. I'm saying I have my relatives who are they were brought up, I guess, as Democrats, but as they made money, they became stupid or they became
Igumfu.
Well,
anyway, I got mine. Fu.
Okay. Well, anyway, they one of them lives in my mother's aunt. My mother's sister lives in Boca Raton. And she is the most. Or Barack Obama, you check his. Now I'm not talking about. It's past. Barack Obama is. I don't even deal with that anymore. That's over. It's over. He's got a few more months left, and then now my next question is: I asked the Tea Parties, and I asked the Republican fence, who do you expect to put into office? Who would you like to see in office? Don't tell me anybody but Obama, because I'm getting that regularly. I want you to tell me who you think you would like to see on this planet run this U.S. government and theoretically running the world. So how would you like, who would you like? I want your answer. And then they give me their answer, and I say, now do you think it's going to change much? And they say, well, no, they're all going to be about the same. I said, well, yeah, the one will be maybe help you and your kids better than the other. But oh, you're right, the system is going to maintain the status quo. It's like a shell game where the big guys, the big money, is going to put the big money in place no matter what, even though believe me, and they yell at me because I admit that I voted. I think Barack
Obama. No, I'm not going to yell at you.
Well, no, I mean, they yell at me because how could you be such an ass to vote for Barack Obama twice? I said, well, first of all, I had no one else to vote for.
Romney would be so good.
Well, my point was I couldn't do Romney. I just couldn't do it. And I was very disappointed in Obama, and I don't mean to say Obama. I want to say in our president, when the first thing he got into office after his Peace Prize, his Peace Prize, he sent drones in. I mean, my wife and I looked at each other, and we couldn't believe it.
Yeah, drones of peace.
I mean, this was
eternal peace.
Well, it's not fair to laugh, because if I don't laugh, tears will come to my eyes. I mean, at what point in time do we say there's something that we can't keep on playing the political game? There's something. But by the way, we got to do something. I'm not saying sit back and do nothing. That's the last thing I want to see happen. But I want to see something that works. I want to see something. We need to step away from the political arena. We need to step away from all this stuff, as Dr. Bill said one day, we need to have elect leaders who put the ladders up in the right spot. And I'm saying to you that we don't see where the roof is falling down from. And I mean, this is it's frightening because no one sees it on either side. And when you step back, you say, my God, there's something systemically wrong. And I just feel so inept not to be able to explain this better.
Well, I don't think it's a failure of your skills in communication. I think it is an indicator of the breadth and scope of the problem. But for me, hearing Louise Slaughter say that she has and begging the for-profit media to acknowledge that these people are not interested in getting anything accomplished, that they are not interested in governing, that they see government as a fault and not a feature, that to me is a beginning toward a solution.
I concur, but you honestly believe that one voice like that, and by the way, I believe one voice does make a difference, or I wouldn't be talking to you now. The one voice makes a difference, but the main media is not going to give for that voice. They're bought and paid for by the Koch brothers and by the Democrats and Republicans got this screwed over. It's not just one. It's the more you look at this, you know, it's not just one side of the aisle. They put in the whole thing has been infiltrated. The whole thing has been screwed over. The whole thing is wrong. So I'm just suggesting that there is another way to there has to be another way. I know there's a chink in this armor somewhere, but if we continue to go from year to year pushing the same buttons and hoping for a better result, that is totally bogus. We can't keep doing the same thing day after day, year after year, and hoping for a better result. I think though, if we had a contest and we said to people, okay, we know what we're doing is wrong. What other ideas can we come up with that may work? We know that changing the political system, in most cases, at some point in time, it might have worked before Ronald Reagan. But now it's not working any longer. Now, since the Vietnam War, the media has been taken over. So we have no way of getting any truth out. The internet is filled with insanities that people want to believe in. They want to believe end times are going to be here. They want to believe that don't worry about it.
Yeah, well, it's a phenomenon that is most frequently identified by and identifiable by people who have been through some sort of addiction recovery. It is called magical thinking. that really is the term. It's where a person on an individual basis, Jeff, gets so mired in the disaster of his or her own existence that they begin to think that somehow or another, as bad as things have gotten, they'll get better because tomorrow I'll win the lottery, or they'll get better because Jesus will come and cleanse and purify the world and bring the new Jerusalem.
No, but
I love it that you laugh when I say that because that reinforces for me how ludicrous it is. But the thing we have to understand at the same time, Jeff, is that it is a very, very real phenomenon. And so all these teabaggers out there, you know, if we could just get that man in our White House out of there, things would be better. You know, the story from the other night about these upstanding, God-fearing Christians who are crowdsourcing the assassination of Barack Obama even as we speak.
No, I'm very much aware. The point, and they're going to keep on doing that, and we're going to keep on playing the same game. There's something there, we know everybody. No matter whether you're a Tea Partier or you're a believer in flying saucers of the God Almighty, or whatever they want to believe in, that's what they believe in. And you're right. You can't change that. You will never. That's their belief system. There's a fellow who wrote a book. He runs a website called the Pine, Pine Cone Utopia. He just finished a book that's about 300 pages. He's a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and he. It's an excellent book about what's the thinking process of human beings, and it's a marvelous book. But it explains where we are right now in our thinking process. Unfortunately, this is a very frightening phase we're in, and I wish there was a simple way to answer this, but I think it's going to take a different. And he said that he agrees with this. We have to be able to get out of the way we're thinking now. We have to be able to look at the reality of where we're in now. We also have to be able to understand how it's changed and how we are. In fact, all of us, because of the mainstream media, with sound bites, is being controlled, but not for any other reason. Only reason not to take down the United States, but it's to run the world with world economy, and it's not a question of money. These people have more money than
no. And you know what? Almost in any direction in which you might look, when you're operating with the economic compass that you do, Jeff, I will say that if you scratch the surface in any direction on the compass rose. And you're gonna eventually you'll uncover hydrocarbons.
That's right. This is how I got involved with the economy. I'm asking myself a question: Why haven't we? This is the renewable energy industry should have taken off 20 years ago. There's no reason for a hydrocarbon. There's no reason whatsoever for it. But the reason why it's not happening. It's because the economic system is stopping it from happening, not the political system. The political system is controlling. I mean, the economic system is controlling.
Well, I mean, look, I saw a clip on the local news last night of my senator, Joe Manchin, who, in his sort of buttermilky voice, said, "Well, statistics show that we're going to use more and more coal for the next 200 years, and." It's going to be in use more and more in the whole wide world, and all I'm asking is why can't we do it better? And of course, I ran screaming into the yard fractionalized toxicity. Yeah, okay, let's change it from coal-related deaths at say. 50,000 a year, let's make it 20. And that way, and thereby reduce the deaths by 30,000. Now, somebody tell me how the 30,000, or how the 20,000 who are still going to die, somebody tell me how they feel about Joe Manchin doing it better.
The point is that the reason why we're still doing this. This guy is paid a lot of money to run for office by the petroleum industry and other facsimile industries. Now, somebody says to me, how much do you get paid for a talk? How much do you get? I said, I don't get paid at all. And they said, why not? I said, because first of all, if I got paid, I'd be a special interest. And you'd be blaming me for being a special interest. So the special interest, and the special interest, by the way, people tell me, well, those school teachers, they have their special interests. I hear that, I want to go off the wall. But I don't. I just say, you know, I don't think...
Jeff, you are a man of great restraint.
I've been doing this too long, man. But anyway, what I'm saying is that we got to figure out, and I hate to drop the ball in your lap, but I really would like to do that, because I'm getting just too old for this stuff. We need to figure out there's something else radically wrong, and we got to change our tack. I sailed boats for many years, and if you just after a while, when you're not moving along fast enough, you got to change your tack. And the reason why we haven't had a reasonably good industry, a renewable fuel industry in this world, is strictly because the economic system is stopping it. The political system, it looks like the political system is stopping it. And I and friends of mine have gotten, before Obama got elected, all kinds of letters that, oh, we're going to work together, and he tried.
Oh, no. I'm not disagreeing with that, Jeff. I mean, for instance, there's that outfit out there called the Blue-Green Alliance. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yes.
It's I think, basically the Sierra Club coming together with organized labor and saying, you know, we're going to lead the world into a clean energy future, but so far not so much.
No.
I see it as a rather cynical partnership whereby organized labor gets to claim that it has some green street cred and gets the environmentalists off their backs, and the Sierra Club gets to say, see, we're providing solutions because we're the smart people.
It's a very interesting thing. I went to one of the environment groups in New York State, a fair-sized group, and I said, look, why don't we do this? And they said, you know, we have to keep money coming in, so we have to have winnable battles. And I realized...
Oh, I know. I saw a pitch come through my email from Michael Brune, ostensibly from Mike Brune, the head of the Sierra Club, the other day. Last day to save the gray wolf. Really? Really? If I don't send my $5 right now, the gray wolf's going to die? I hate myself. I'm broke.
It gets worse.
Last day to save the gray wolf. Last day to save the hillbilly.
I had a talk with Nate, and I think he's a great human being. And I said, you know, what are we doing, man? I mean, you know this. He said, look, you really got to understand. It's very you want to pick on the and this guy's he's got more nerve than any human being I know to do what he's done. But on the same token, the same game. We've got to have winnable battles. Well, my God, man, just go after the jugular vein. And if you don't, you're going to lose anyway. Well, why lose slow when you can lose when you may be able to have a fighting chance to win? If I know that a guy's going to be killing me, I got to go right after the thing, and hopefully I can save myself and then maybe save that character. If I, you know, I believe that you give everybody an even break. But you know what I'm saying? You got to go after the jugular vein. And I think our problem is when. We are so far lost. We are so far lost that anyway. I don't want to tie up the.
I do need to roll along because you have.
I don't want to pull every time, but I am a one pony show here, kid. But I just feel as though I've been trying to figure out to get away from this one pony show, and I just can't. It's just too obvious. It's too obvious. The problem lies within the economic system, and that's controlling our political system. And it should be attacked. We should go after this. We need human beings have to have value, not gold, not silver, not currency. Human beings need to have a value, and that must come sometime.
Well, I tell you, I don't know how to establish that, but it's been a great conversation. I'm sorry you've been under the weather. I was wondering why you wasn't hearing from you. I hope you're back to feeling considerably better. You've inspired some phone lines to light up. So let's see what folks have to say.
Enjoy, guys. Keep up the good work. Bye, babe.
All right, take care, Jeff. Bye now. Jeff calling from parts unknown. He said warmer part of the world. I assume he's down in Florida, Stan. I'm going right to the phones, I promise. Throw a couple of things out there. Had a note from our buddy Sal, who is there day in and day out to help us keep this all going. Sal said, I will match the next $50 that comes in support of the fundraising goal. And I think I speak for all of us when I say we're all deeply grateful to Sal for that. So there's a $50 challenge on the table. If you give $5, it'll become $10. If you give $50, it'll become $100. The next $50 that comes in to help keep the horn on the air. Thank you very much, Sal. Thank you indeed. So hopefully that will be a little bit of inspiration. And, you know, we've got a $250 hole that we're in right now. So if we can
If somebody will match Sal, and then somebody will match that, and somebody will match that, and somebody will match that, we'll be back above ground right quick. A note coming in from our buddy Horst, he says, in regard to some of the stuff that Jeff was saying, he said, you know, we aren't going to get anywhere near the consensus needed to make a massive change in our system of government, short of a violent revolution that would, in this particular chapter of history, equate to a potential death sentence for the species. Multiply Fukushima by about 200 for an idea of what happens if the lights go out on civilization for a few weeks. Yeah, I mean, look, we've just, and I don't know how much the rest of the world was paying attention, Fukushima is a horror. And here in West Virginia, for about 2 months, we've had a situation where people can't feel like they're safe drinking water from their taps. Okay, it gets real ugly real quick. I mean, the state government now in West Virginia said, go ahead and drink the water. And yet there's an elementary school in Kanawha County, Midland Trail Elementary School, that says, no, we're going to keep drinking the bottled water, thank you very much, because we're in the business of educating children, not poisoning them. So I understand what Horst is getting at. He continues, we're in a situation akin to fleeing an erupting volcano in a car with three wheels. We need to slap another wheel on that bad boy and get the F out of here ASAP. We don't have time to design a new car from the ground up, especially not with teabaggers and the GOP sabotaging the works. If we make it to safety, we can build a better car then. I'm not talking about clean air and water here. We do need to do whatever we can as fast as we can. I mean, all this is in the context of arguments to make massive changes to our economic and political systems in order to deal with our immediate problems. Thanks very much to Horst. He says, challenge met. Thanks to Sal for putting it up. Okay, if anybody wants to match what Horst is doing, then we will be on our way to a significantly better place than we are right now here on the 6th day of March 2014. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John. How you doing?
Hey, John, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. Listen, it was a really, I should say I'm freezing. But aside from that, I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Yeah, it's effing cold.
Yeah.
Not as bad today, and it looks like it's going to get better, but I'm sick of it.
I know, and I am cold, and I really feel kind of sheepish because I know folks in, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, not to say anything about Canada, have it way colder than we do, but I'm a southerner. You know, this is too cold for me. So.
Yeah, my sister lives on the Gulf Coast in Alabama. And she starts freezing at about 60 degrees.
Yeah, I feel I'm with her on that. I thought that was a really interesting call. I would say I don't want to go maybe too far down this road, but we do have a measure of human value, and it's the human worth, and it's the value of human labor.
Yes.
I think Jeff was talking about, you know, we need a way of sort of measuring human value. It's there. I mean, it's sort of baked into the recipe. So it doesn't matter what sort of monetary system you have. It's like, you know, the socially accepted, the socially useful labor that people can do is their value, and that's how we measure it, and that's how we pay it, you know. So the measure exists. Now, a way to make it more equitable, that's a bigger question.
A much bigger question. I appreciate a lot of what Jeff is saying, insofar as maybe I think there's value in having a different starting point, John, where we talk about appropriate access to food, clothing, shelter, and education as some of those unalienable rights, and that everything then proceeds from there. How good is an education that just gets you into a position where you have to go to work in the corporate world for whatever they're willing to pay to pay off student debts that will be crippling you until you're 50? Do you see my point?
Yeah, that's a great point. And you know, Dr. Bill spent part of last week and most of this week really talking about similar issues. And I think it's a great one. And that's actually exactly what I wanted to try to bring to the table, because I think that the whole concept of human rights, and you said inalienable rights, and I'm glad you did. I think this whole concept of human rights needs a lot more unpacking than we do. do. We sort of assume that there are naturally things that are, the rights of people as humans, but we don't really seem to do a good job of asking or thinking about what those actually are. And what I was thinking about was the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
That's amazing, because I just went and read through it as Jeff and I were talking. So we went.
I'm so glad. It's striking both for what is there and what is not there. Did you notice anything about it? Did anything strike you about either of those things?
Well, I know right off the bat that when it was passed, it was found sort of wanting insofar as there was no protection for sexual orientation.
Right.
There was no protection. We bend over backwards to protect religion.
Exactly. Right.
But there was no overt protection for people who choose not to be religious.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, what is protected? Well, the right to property is protected.
Yes.
Enshrined. The right to religion is enshrined, and those are two things that have led to immense amount of exploitation and oppression. What is not protected? A wage, or the right to not have one. None of that is in there. And I think if we think about what is literally inalienable, like in the actual sense, things that you cannot separate from a human and have them still continue to be a human, it's really pretty basic. I mean, it's food, water, shelter, and reproductive freedom. I mean, that's at the end of the day what you need to, go on being a human as a member of a group. Everything else is gravy. I mean, it's important gravy, obviously. But we need to settle those three or four basic issues before we can think about anything else.
What you mentioned about property, what protection is there for people who have different views of property? What if
absolutely none?
What if people reject the Western, the European view of property or reject individual ownership? And what you reminded me of when you brought that up, John, is something that I saw my good friend Mike Wiggins Jr., who's the chair of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe people, on his Facebook the other day. He posted this. Now listen to this and just see if it because this just knocked me down. And Mike just does this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I've heard him. Right. He
says, there's no end. After we preserve the Bad River watershed and acquire the Pinoki mineral rights, future tribal councils will still have to remember that exploding our headwaters for money is not our Anishinaabe way. 25 years from now, 100 years from now, and 1,000 years from now, we best get hunting, fishing, and gathering, and then pass it on.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's that kind of, at least the way I read it, that's an entirely different understanding of property than anything that Hobbes or Locke or Montesquieu or any of those progenitors of the Enlightenment ever conceived of.
Oh, absolutely, and chills from that. That's great. But that is exactly, and there is value in that labor. I mean, collecting foods from nature is a transformation of nature by human labor. There is value and there is worth in that. And that is the kind of thing that is sustainable. It can be perpetuated, and it exists entirely outside of a concept of property. So when folks talk about the sort of Western bias of this human rights discourse, that's what they're talking about. That's exactly what they mean. Right? And if you accept that the problem is this sort of exploitative capitalist system, and again, I don't want to alienate anyone here, but if you accept that that's the issue, then you can't support the Declaration of Human Rights because it enshrines this right to property. And from that is the thing from which all other exploitations come from.
Right, and it's predicated on a notion of unending, ceaseless, infinite cannibalistic consumption.
Accumulation and consumption, yeah.
I mean, that's why I had the little hissy that I had when Jeff mentioned his buddy who thinks that everything would be better if we just went back to the gold standard. I mean, I kick furniture over thinking like that, John, I do.
Yeah.
But it's and like I said earlier, you know, everything seems to come down. You know, if you dig down deep enough into it, it comes down to something involving a hydrocarbon.
Mm-hmm.
And with that being, I mean, obviously some of these property concepts were developed before hydrocarbons really entered the discussion, I guess you could say.
Sure.
But the discussion has been turned toward how an ownership property based society can best serve a hydrocarbon energy system. And somewhere along the way, there has to be a discussion about what's going to happen when it isn't there anymore. I mean, there's no way that you can look at the Keystone XL or the tar sands or fracking or coal, or any kind of oil exploration. There's no way that you can look at that and not realize that the extremes that they are having to go to in order to recover this stuff does not represent some sort of a death knell writ large.
And the question is, are there things that we can do now to make the landing be a little softer than it's going to be if we don't prepare at all? Now, very similar to the climate change debate, I think. And I don't pretend to be Mr. Solution. I don't have any easy answers for this because they're thorny problems and they're going to require a lot of people and a lot of changes to our thinking. But I guess, what is the rights? What do we have a right to? I mean, you know, think about what's protected in our Constitution, you know, property and, you know, the right to bear arms and the right to express ourselves freely and the right for free religion and all that stuff. You know, other countries don't do that, right? Iceland doesn't guarantee the right to bear arms, but it guarantees the right to food and shelter and an old age pension and health care. You know, so what we think is important and sustainable are really different from place to place, and we can't have this sort of blanket discussion about, you know, freedom and liberty and property and guns and religion, because all that stuff really misses the point.
Well, you know, I was thinking of you earlier today when I saw one of the statements coming out of the CPAC convention, and you know that photograph of that empty room just speaks volumes.
Yes.
But one of the rooms that was not empty was visited by one Wayne LaPierre.
Oh, charming.
Yeah, of the National Republican Rifle Association.
Yeah.
And he declared, and I wish this was a joke, but it isn't. And the reason I said I thought of you was, you know, you're the one who introduced us to the notion that there's freedom. And then there's the freedom to choose among 29 different kinds of breakfast cereal.
Yeah.
And so there's Wayne LaPierre, who shows up on the stage at CPAC and declares to them that true freedom is, and if you need to sit down or strap in or something, I'll understand, John.
I'm sitting.
He declared that true freedom is, and this is a quote, all the rifles, shotguns, and handguns we want.
Oh, God.
I've never been worried about this country until now, he said. We fear for the safety of our families. It's why neighborhood streets that were once filled with bicycles and skateboards and laughter in the air now sit empty and silent. That's why more Americans are buying firearms and ammunition, not to cause trouble, because that America is already in trouble.
Wow.
And, of course, then, and again, this is another one of those little prophecy moments based on stuff that Brother Albert and I were talking about last night. The NRA CEO pointed the finger of blame at Democrats for Solyndra, Benghazi, Fast and Furious, Obamacare, massive unemployment, a debt that will choke our grandchildren, and one executive order after another right on top of each other.
Well,
that's like, I don't know, he's on some kind of right-wing acid. But really, freedom of the press? No, you know, it'll be okay if you've got a gun. And these things have real world implications for me. I mean, and I'm even subject to them. For instance, some years back, after one significant power outage, our good friend, horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner, provided me with a little portable inverter generator.
Uh-huh.
And I try to keep it in working order and everything. And so a week or so ago, while we were all out of the house, somebody just came up onto the porch and decided that it was no longer my property, but it was their property.
Oh, yeah.
And a few days later, they came along. Because, you know, this is West Virginia. I mean, there's sometimes the doors aren't locked.
Yeah.
And we are armed to the damn teeth in this state, so that if you want to go a-stealing, you have to understand that you might, you know, bad things happen.
Yeah.
And so a few days later, a weed eater disappeared. Now, I don't have the wherewithal to replace any of that.
Right.
But, you know, there's that concept of property ownership. And I just had to look at it and say, well, if he can't live without it, I guess I can.
Yeah.
But by the same token, I would be lying, John, if I didn't say that I guess, you know, the lizard brain kicked in and I thought, maybe it's time to go buy me a gun. And then I just kind of pulled back and said, what in God's name are you saying?
Right. Right, right. Because, I mean, you don't look at these things. You don't fetishize them to the sense that it's, you know, a greater value to you than some human life, you know, flawed though it may be.
I'm gonna take somebody's life over a weed eater?
Right. Would you get off if you did in West Virginia? I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a sort of a kind of a stand your ground kind of thing.
No, it's more like the old affirmative hillbilly defense of the sorry bastard had it coming.
That's right. Yeah, had it coming. Yeah, but see, again, that's sort of a consequence of the way that we sort of, you know, when we do our labor and we get our wage and we make these commodities and we sell them to people we don't know and we feed and clothe ourselves with other ones, you know, we start to think of all things as objects, including other humans. You know, it's a sort of a pernicious thing. So, you know, you're not Bob who lives down the street. You're the guy who left his weed eater out, and whatever, I need a weed eater, so I'll take it.
Yeah, because, you know, maybe there's enough metal in it to sell for salvage, and maybe I can get some pills.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, you know,
because this place has a grief index that's on a par with Gaza.
Right. Yeah. No. I don't doubt it. I mean, I've had things stolen, and I've kind of come to the same place that you did about that. I'm like, well, shit. You know, if they need it, I mean, fine. I can deal. But you know, we when we step back and think about the really just diffuse implications of, you know, how we go about our daily sort of economic lives, it's scary. It really is. And you know, y'all were talking the other day about that movie 12 Years a Slave, and like that's just such a profound movie, I think, and people need to see it because it is it really drives home that point, is that when we start to think about other people as objects, as simply instruments to achieve what we need or as having a set value, we get demeaned just the way they get demeaned and dehumanized. And it runs through the system we have. I guess the last thing I would say is that going back to the whole idea of, you know, can we make our landing when the hydrocarbon industry collapses, when our debt collapses, to try to make things, you know, a little bit easier and simpler. I'm a little bit nervous about calls for, you know, guaranteed living wages and guaranteed, you know, minimum basic wages, because I feel that, you know, if you think about just sort of basic economic stuff, the more that we guarantee incomes for people, the less companies and industries have to pay their workers, and they're still going to get workers, which means they can expand, they can buy more stuff, they can dig more mines, they can build more nuclear plants. I feel like that is a kind of a risky road to go down because it seems to be encouraging, you know, the owners.
You're encouraging a greater yeah. likelihood of an expansion of the exploitative state.
You see where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just really, really nervous when people start talking about that like it's a solution to the problem, because again, that's a top level, that's a surface effect. The issue, the real problem is the natural exploitation that comes about from wages and property, you know? And I can say that all comfortable because I don't have an answer. I'm sorry to say that, but.
Well, but if you did, I would be a little bit suspect, John, because I'm naturally suspicious of people who, you know, I got it. Because while you've gone to some pains to explain, for instance, the concept of scientific elegance, not too many moving parts, if you will, that result in a larger understanding. I don't know if that's necessarily transferable in a social setting.
Oh, I think we're infinitely more complex than the most complex molecule. That's my impression. That's my feeling, and maybe it's what I tell myself to feel better at night because none of this is easy. But yeah,
if it was, what fun would it be?
Exactly. That's also comforting. All right, Bob. I'm gonna back off here. So thanks for listening, and I'm enjoying the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure, John. Thank you so much for the ideas you bring.
All right. Cheers.
Take care.
Bye.
Dr. John, who always adds an element of perspective that. He's got a way of saying things that make sense in my head when I'm trying to say them, and they're not making sense in my head, and I really appreciate it. Let's keep things rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy. What's happening?
Hey, I saw a story a couple days ago that caught my attention. I guess, I'm not sure what state it was, but there was a trans student who claimed that they were beaten up. Well, I didn't hear a whole lot of major news.
Is this the one out of California where the trans boy was beaten and raped in the bathroom?
Yes, and then he came out, and I'm suspicious on both ends, or not both ends, but on the ends that he came out after the fact and said it didn't happen. I think the fact that it became such a big story made him fear for worse repercussions if it came out and actually had happened.
Well, I read that story with some misgivings too, and this may wind up being a negative commentary on me. But the first thing I thought was when the story broke, and in essence, it is as it's been described, a teenager, a trans male teenager, was said to have been brutally assaulted. Is there any other way to be assaulted? That adverb probably didn't need to be there. But was assaulted in the boys' bathroom, and the boys who assaulted him beat, stomped, and then raped him. And my first thought after thinking, you know, God, thank God, whatever, that the boy is okay, was to think, well, the right wingers are going to be all over this, and see, that's why we can't let them in the bathroom. If that trans boy had been going to the girls' bathroom like God made her to, this never would have happened. And that, because that's the way these people think. They think in terms, you know, if something awful like that happens, they don't look at the conduct of the perpetrators. They look at the innocent victim as somehow making it a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, we're going to have problems in the bathroom now. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and the reason I brought it up is because, like I said, I saw the story initially reported on CNN. And I was like, well, that's interesting. And I happened to be the same night listening to an iHeartRadio station, which is Clear Channel, which you can guess what their news source is.
Oh, you betcha.
So I'm listening, and I probably was listening for a good 3 or 4 hours to a couple different things. And the whole time, their news source, we won't mention them because I don't want to talk about them, never said a damn thing about the story at all. As soon as it broke, if the kid came back out and said that, hey, this didn't happen, or it happened differently than I said it did, they recorded that instantly. Like, it was breaking news. Like, it was some horrible thing. Like, oh my God, look, this kid lied, and this is why they're dangerous. That's the way it went down, and I was appalled at it. I was like, really? You couldn't tell the rest of the story, but as soon as it turned out that this kid did whatever he did and probably had to take it back, that's what you report.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's...
And of course, then there's the old, balance routine after they say it too, which is total bullshit.
Right, exactly.
So I saw that, and I was pretty enraged. That piece of audio you played earlier tonight, that was pretty inspiring to hear someone actually, you know, basically screaming from the high hill saying, hey, we've got these big buildings, and there's only a select number of us here, and we spend X mountains of millions a day to run these buildings, and these people sit on their ass somewhere else, not getting anything done. Or they come here and block things being done because someone upstairs is paying them.
Right, because they have... I think Representative Slaughter still needs to take the next step and say, because they are hostile to the idea of the government, the idea of constitutional governance, as we have experienced it for more than two centuries now, almost two and a half.
Right, I sent you that email earlier. I'm waiting for the day when someone, and I'd like to think Bernie would do it someday when he's had enough. We'll just pick his hand up, point across the hill and say, that jackbooted bug over there is the problem in this country. Right there, you're looking at him. That guy, not my friend, that jackbooted bug.
Yeah, I read a story the other day that I guess somebody out there is floating this notion of running Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III for president of the United States. And I was hit by a wave of nausea. I mean, the room spun around. That, oh my God, can you imagine?
I can't put it in language. That's what that is. I think Jeff had mentioned earlier, when he was talking, that it's true. I have friends from all different sides, and a lot of them I steer clear of things because they're so either fundamentalist Bible thumpers or so right-wing neocons. I can be friends with them in terms of movies and popular things, but you talk about anything else, it becomes a real clash because...
No, and you know, I have to recognize the way these biases work in my own life, too, Jeremy, because just as a for instance, I was out and about earlier today, and I saw a car... And it had, our here in West Virginia, our license plates only go on the back. We only have them on the back. We don't put them on the front, like some states do. And I saw this car, and the front bumper plate was, it wasn't the full-on yellow. It was just a white background with the black coiled snake, and underneath it said, "Don't tread on me." And my first impression was, oh, great, one of them. Well, that image has been around for a very long time, obviously, since the days of the Revolution, and it used to mean somebody that was really fiercely, fiercely American, fiercely a protector of liberty, and freedom and all of that. But it's been transformed into an icon of political ignorance and cultural hate. And I had to check my own bias in that, Jeremy, because I thought, I don't necessarily know this person. I don't know if this person's a teabagger or using that image in an old in its old school sense. But the larger inquiry was into myself, because I felt that bias happening and I didn't like it. I don't like prejudging people. If judgments have to be made, they need to be based on evidence and the facts.
Right, but in saying that too, sometimes we all, no one's perfect, that's quite clear. And everyone likes to say they don't judge, they don't necessarily stereotype, but everyone has that fight or flight thing in them where within the first 10 seconds you decide, is this person an asset or is it someone dangerous to me? And that changes your whole outcome of how you treat people normally. It happens. People want to say it doesn't, but it's there, it happens. And I have no other way to explain this, but when I, about 2007, I was working for one of the major delivery companies in the United States, and here in Vermont, I had my route, I was doing my route, and there's two houses. One was decidedly anti-Obama, and one was for Obama. They were both different races, and you can guess who was for what. So they both lived on a separate side of the street. So when the one family put up the Obama sign, the other family raised the Confederate flag.
Oh, really?
I'm not even kidding. And this is in Vermont, and they raised it high and proud next to the Vermont flag, and it stayed there until the election was over. And it was exactly what it looked like. the white family with the Confederate flag and the African American family with the Obama sticker or the Obama plaque on their front yard.
And then, of course, what Angry was talking about last night about the Confederate battle flag flying in Ukraine now.
Ew. That doesn't terribly surprise me because I've mentioned, I think, several different places that I was in a relationship with someone born and raised in Russia for a number of years. And she always told me that in Russia, what you see here is 10 times worse there in terms of hate. Definitely there's a fear of definitely talk the Olympics. There's a fear of anti-gay or anti-gay movement there.
Well, did you see where the women from Pussy Riot were attacked? Again?
No, I didn't see their attack again.
They had caustic chemicals thrown on them. They were sitting eating a meal in McDonald's somewhere in Russia and were attacked with caustic chemicals by Russian partisans of Vladimir Putin.
I just don't understand some of these people because she definitely told me that there was the anti-gay movement. And then even more deeply hated than we have here, some fractions of like the KKK, that exists in Russia, but in a major, major section of Russia, where if you're not white, blue-eyed, blonde hair, you're spit upon. And basically every word you can think of is thrown out in the street and there's no stopping it. So there's a lot of issues going on in that country, and I really, 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 really hope that neither side decides, you know, because both when it comes to both countries, Russia and us, we're both trigger happy. And we'll go into something half-cocked just because the other person said the wrong thing or gave the wrong look. And it can become real nasty real quick. And it won't be bulletproof, the exchange between the two of us.
Right. I had to look it up real quick. I just found it. The report says that. I'll have it here in a second. There it is. Two members of Pussy Riot were left with chemical burns and head injuries after they were attacked by youths in a branch of McDonald's. Maria Alyokina and Nadezhda Tolokonikova, wow, proud of myself, were left covered in green stains after an organized group of young men attacked them with antiseptic, pepper spray, and weapons. Tolokonikova's husband, Pyotr Veresilov, said in an email to Agence France. Six young men wearing patriotic Russian symbols shouting obscenities at the women, and one held up a placard saying, "Dirty whores, get out of the city." This happened in Nizhny Novgorod. So
Putin is a thug. He was a spy for his country and paramilitary and everything else. So, you know, we've probably all seen the videos. 60 minutes.
I just want to be careful. That I don't do what I despise, and that is to somehow caricatureize someone. I have a feeling he is a very, very, very bad human being.
Right, I accept that. I understand that.
Apparently, according to something that Angry sent over my way a few minutes ago. Bugged telephone call, a diplomat has said he was told that Ukrainian protesters used snipers against their own people. So, finding the clean hands in this is going to be a real mess.
You know, when I look at Putin, and I'm going to say a name, and I'm not comparing the two, so no one out there take this this way. But there's those famous audio recordings from Hitler. And like I said, I'm not comparing the two. But when I look at someone like Putin, I have to wonder sometimes if it's not a similar in terms of the way they run their media and get people's attention. Like, in this audio recording that came out way after World War II, like in the 70s, of Hitler. He was totally different when amongst his own friends, when he thought nobody was listening, he didn't talk that way. And in fact, even in the recording, I think he said something like, I do this to push my propaganda, I'm not really doing it. But I mean, he was just a totally different person. And I have to wonder sometimes if Putin's like that too in that case, where this public image is something he puts out there, sphere and dominant, but it isn't necessarily him, but he's kind of forced to do it.
Yeah, and I think another thing that comes into play here, though, is that we must remember, and I'm in agreement with Jim's assertion on this, that he wants to reconstitute the geographic and geopolitical power of the Soviet Union. But let's understand that this man, while he has an autocratic streak, understands that he is now riding a capitalist pony. And so, when you put those two together, the power of the state and the power of the corporate aristocracy, I think we already have a pretty well-defined explanation of what that becomes. And, hint, it ain't communism. The guy who invented it called it fascism, being Benito Mussolini. He said what we call fascism should more properly be understood as corporatism, because it is the marriage of the power of the state with the power of business.
Right, I agree with that.
And that's I think we can probably understand Vladimir Putin as having some pretty fascist urges.
Yeah, I would.
And of course he's also leveraging, since the fall of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the suppression of religion, you got to understand, we've also, and we as Americans understand so little of Russian culture in the first place. But the Russian Orthodox Church, even through the Soviet era, somehow managed to maintain enough of a death grip on the Russian and affiliated peoples that when the Soviet Union fell, it stepped into that power vacuum with a bloody vengeance. Let's remember the whole Pussy Riot thing began when they were accused of not being sufficiently obsequious to Russian Orthodoxy.
Right.
You've got a marriage of capital to authoritarian autocracy, to an entrenched and deeply bigoted religious structure, and that way lies madness.
I would agree. I know from my own dealings with now ex-wife, like I said, she was born and raised there, and when you mention bad people, there's one name that would always come up out of her mouth: Stalin.
Yeah.
Stalin, what he did to their own people was, she would say time and time again, was far worse than what Hitler dreamed of doing, was what Stalin did to his own people. So there's that, too. I mean, they've definitely been through repression, and they know what it is to be ruled by a tyrannical person.
Oh, without a doubt. Jeremy, it's awful good hearing from you. I am glad you keep the duct tape and the tennis balls handy. You've learned the dangers of running out.
Yes, I have.
You have a good evening.
You too.
All right, bye now. Our buddy Jeremy calling from Vermont. A note coming in from Glenn. Glenn says, it's all driven by religion. In the past 20 years or so, I've seen mega monster churches pop up everywhere in my region. They are taking over, I swear to God. Well, they aim to. Theocracy is the goal of, in one degree or another, all the Abrahamic religions. And, there's basically three of them. And that real dynamic tension happens when they rub up against each other. Lines open. Got a couple of blinking lights, and we're going to come back to them in a moment, but we're going to take a little break first. The number, 304-658-3333. Everyone and anyone, unless you're a right-winger, are welcome to participate in the conversation. And I want to extend thanks. Sal put a $50 challenge on the table. Horst answered that.
And then Diane and Gary and Karen answered that. So at this point in time, we are only $100 away from getting up out of the hole that we have gotten, that we find ourselves in on the 6th day of March 2014. So if anybody wants to match what Gary and Karen and Diane did, it'll be a huge help. PayPal button, or just if you want to do it by mail, just shoot me a note saying, you know, tell Boss Man Wayne he doesn't have to wear the spider-proof gloves when he goes to the mailbox. Thanks very, very much. Green News Report is up, and after that, more of your calls, 304-658-3333, if you want to reach out and participate in the conversation. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's Thursday, March 6, 2014.
The numbers here are pretty staggering.
Record fine for big coal polluting water 6,000 times in 7 years.
The Keystone Pipeline must be approved. Why?
Opportunistic right-wingers push nonsense on Keystone XL, plus...
Mr. President, say no to this project. I was wrong.
Keystone XL Pipeline loses another key supporter.
All of those sad losses and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It's one of the biggest energy risks this country will ever take. Ever!
Wait, ever?
Ever!
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, this Republican U.S. Senate primary in Colorado is amazing.
Oh, yeah, this debate that was hosted by the Denver Post for Republican candidates who are seeking to unseat Colorado Senator Mark Udall, who's a Democrat.
Six candidates offer you this wide variety of opinions on climate change.
Do you believe our planet is being impacted by man-made global warming, Ken?
No.
Tom?
No.
Tom?
No.
Amy?
No.
What?
Definitely not. No.
So there you have it, the Republican candidates for the U.S. Senate in Colorado. Good luck with that, Rocky Mountain State.
Yeah. Moving on, a record fine for big coal.
The numbers here are pretty staggering. Over 6,000 violations. Hundreds of streams, tributaries, and rivers, over 5 Appalachian states.
One of the largest coal companies in the nation, Alpha Natural Resources, was slapped with a $27 million fine this week, a record after federal regulators found the company violated water pollution limits 6,000 times over 7 years. The company also has to invest $200 million to clean up operations.
6,000 times in 7 years.
Yep.
This company has dumped toxic heavy metal into our rivers and streams.
Yep. Associated Press reporter Dina Capiello tells PBS NewsHour how this relates to other recent big spills in North Carolina and West Virginia.
Coal has a really big footprint on our water resources, from the mining of coal all the way to the burning of coal for electricity and the waste created by that process.
Alpha Natural Resources purchased Massey Energy. That's the company where the Upper Big Branch mine exploded on April 5th, 2010, killing 29 miners. 15 days later, the BP Deepwater Horizon exploded in the Gulf, killing 11 workers there. And all the while, Alpha Resources was getting bigger and bigger and dumping their garbage into the rivers 6,000 times. Seems like a big penalty, $25 million, but this is a $30 billion company, so slap on the wrist.
Yep. MSNBC host Ed Schultz has dramatically reversed his support of the controversial proposed Keystone XL pipeline from Canada after finally understanding the risk it poses to the nation's Ogallala Aquifer, primary water source for the Midwest.
This pipeline, if it's constructed, just like every other pipeline, it will leak. You can count on it. Does the President of the United States want to risk damaging the aquifer? And I'm talking about irreversible damage. Is one of the biggest energy risks this country will ever take. Ever. Ever. Mr. President, say no to this project. I was wrong.
good for Ed Schultz. He came out strong in favor of this pipeline. He got a lot of blowback. He spent the last several weeks talking to all sorts of experts on all sides of the issue, people who are directly affected by Keystone. And in the bargain, he's given more coverage to this issue in the mainstream media than I think anyone else has. And by the way, full disclosure, I have guest hosted for Ed Schultz on his radio show. So I just want to throw that out there. But I think what he's doing here is great, and he's to be congratulated for having the courage to change his position after learning the facts.
The final public comment period on the pipeline ends Friday, March 7th. Tell him what you think at the website regulations.gov, or we have the links at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. Finally, surprise, right-wing Republicans are opportunistically using the conflict in Ukraine to push for the Keystone XL.
The Keystone pipeline must be approved. Why? Because Russia is blackmailing Europe over energy. The more oil and natural gas the USA and Canada can produce and distribute, the weaker Russia becomes on the world stage.
I don't even think I understand that criticism.
Well, don't worry about it, because actual energy experts say the idea that the Keystone Pipeline or bigger U.S. oil and gas exports could possibly be used as a strategic weapon is complete nonsense, and it's just more political opportunism on behalf of the oil and gas industry. Again.
Yeah, and Fox News pushing those interests, I just say it ain't so. Not possible. For much more on that and the stories we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help the Green News Report stay on your public airwaves. For some reason, Fox News and the Keystone XL people just aren't buying the advertising space the way they used to. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
And there we go. Thank you very much, Brad and Desi. And, gee, I wonder where that auto-playing damned audio that was sneaking through there was coming from. Eesh. Never a dull moment. This is, of course, The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday. Thanks going out to Jack, who has taken us down to needing to raise only $80 more to get us up out of the early March hole that we are in at the moment. Thank you very much, Jack. Let's go straightway to the phones. You know the number, 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Bill, what's happening?
Oh, man, it's been a good evening listening to the callers. And last night was excellent with our friend Albert and the Indian tremendous callers.
Oh, absolutely. Conversations with either one are always good.
Well, I'm working on this D&B and food book. I got to the point of the Geneva meetings in '54. What a joke! All around the Americans and French couldn't bring the British on board, or we would have been in that war a lot earlier.
Yeah, I imagine we would have. Maybe it could have been 100,000 dead.
Yeah. Well, say that. I got a bad draft classification at age 18 in 61, so, of course, they tried to change it. You know, they figured, well, we can find a job for you. You can be a cook at a place where we're training guys to go over. Thanks a lot. No, at that point in time, my thinking had completely changed, Bob, from a person who, through the Civil War studies and, you know, you had this opinion based on all the bull crap that you could be fed in school. Although I once had a history teacher refer to me as an occupational hazard, and I still laugh at that. Maybe he found me in trouble that I couldn't stay awake during his lectures. This guy was a one-man Sominex bottle, I'll tell you. There's a lot of those around, but this Ukrainian thing goes deeper than a lot of people understand.
It goes deeper than most Americans have the ability to comprehend.
Yeah, you know,
because we know next to nothing about that part of the globe.
Well, I guess through the study of history, you start picking up a lot of sociological things that go along with the historic things. And for instance, a buddy of mine whose last name ends, like Chuck, you know, the last part of his name, which is an automatic estimation, you know. It's like my last name can be from either Germany, England, Jewish, it's just a common thing, you know. I was the guy that took the wheat in and made and ground it into, here, eat this, it's good for you. Don't even start me. I had a day with my piano player who I spent 30 years working with, so we had breakfast together. And then this evening, a buddy of mine brought me a Sea Crane radio that I had bought off the net to replace mine that was dying of old age and hard use. Those are amazing machines. They're so heavy. They got an antenna in it that this radio can double. You can be a weightlifter. You sit and curl the son of a bitch while you listen to it, you know. Anyway, there's more. I understand from what I have heard from a friend of mine who actually talked to you when I was sick, a history teacher,
yeah,
buddy of mine. He was telling me that from what he's been able to pick up, there's a hell of a lot of Nazis involved in the Ukrainian movement.
That's what keeps coming into conversation. And I can't help thinking back to just, you know, when I was over in Germany and walking around through that lovely little village, and, you know, we were joyfully, gleefully even pulling Nazi slogan stickers off of light standards.
It
doesn't get a hell of a lot of press and probably deserves to have more, Bill. But there's a rising tide of fascist sentiment in Europe.
Yes.
As Angry pointed out, in Norway, I've seen some reports of fascist Swedes heading to Ukraine.
Yeah.
If there was some way that all the fascists would go to one place and they could then be sent off to Valhalla or wherever it is fascists go, maybe it would be a net good. And that comes from somebody who is anti-war. I mean, I probably need to go and, you know, say a few Hail Gandhis over that. But you know what I mean, right?
Yeah. Well, nobody can justify one human being killing another. I can say it in self-defense because you're in the middle of nowhere and there's five people that can't hardly stand up, but they can hurt, five of them can hurt you, you know? Yeah, there's that attitude. But you're right. I mean, of course, the Republicans love this trouble because this is just more stuff to pile on the other guy's plate. And sometimes I'm getting so cynical, Bob, that I think both of these parties might as well, what an acting game they do.
I think some of them do, but you know, I would give anything very dearly love to see more people come round to Louise Slaughter's way of thinking. We've got to stop this business of thinking that there's some sort of collegiality or camaraderie to be had with a bunch of insurgents whose goal is the destruction of this constitutional government.
Yeah.
What's left of it, I guess we should say.
What's left of it is correct. It hurts, but this idea that we should... Are these people seriously thinking and talking about war with the Soviet Union? Folks, count the missiles.
Right. This is not going to be... No.
Yeah, this isn't... What's-his-name in Iraq? Of course, who sold him his weapons, too? And, hell, Iran was loaded with American jet planes when Khomeini the Ayatollah came back to reinstitute the 12th century, you know. They had plenty of weaponry from this country, so, you know. When you're purveyor of weapons to the rest of the world, as we have become, Ike warned us about the military-industrial complex, and coming from an alleged Republican, that was good news. And I keep coming back to the fact that one of the biggest voices to keep this country out of the open warfare in Indochina was was Matthew Ridgway, who, you know, who had led paratroopers and had taken over command of the U.N. Army in Korea after Walton Walker died. Walker died in a car wreck, and Walker was one of a combat man for a right-hand man for Patton, who died in a car accident, if I'm not mistaken. And what goes around coming, you see these coincidences, Doug, have you shaking your head after a while.
Right.
But what I hear tonight is, it's like, what do we do? Bob, I heard so much of the same stuff in 1966-7. And what happened, you know, the economy got going and people got happy and you get, well, as you're tied up in what I was tied up in at certain times in my life, the survival game.
Sure.
Economic survival situation. Because that in itself is, well, you have three children that you have together with Agnes, right?
Well, four in total.
What was it, four?
We've got four kids.
Okay. And you know, the battles.
Ranging
battles
from 26 to 16.
Jeez, yeah, well, I had an affair with a rich girl from Cleveland Heights and seduced a girl that found me when she was 26. And the funny thing was, she was talking on the adoption network to a woman that was down in Texas, and she mentioned my name. The woman fell off the chair because she and I had an affair. The woman.
Oh, Texas, my God.
Yeah. And then the woman from Texas called me. I talked to her and her husband for about 3 hours. The guy she married was a guy that I really liked, and it was delightful to see the two of them get together, and they produced a family, too. And, oh, God, you know, it's, well, you know, life is the damn music business. I keep coming back to that. In fact, my buddy has stopped today to bring me the Sea Crane. He just brought me half a dozen CDs that he made from a lot of old New Orleans jazz that I had on LP. Some that was recorded in the 1940s, for Christ's sake. But, you know, coming back to the reality of the situation, this is not a... Quite honestly, Bob, this is like freaking none of our business. I mean, it's horrible to see what could happen. But do you know how much wheat the Ukrainians produce for that part of the world?
They are the third largest net exporter of grain in the world.
Yeah. Well, that's what hurts so bad.
I mean, there's every possibility in the world that when you go and buy your bag of Wonder Bread, you know, it's a wonder anybody can eat it.
Yeah, you got that right.
That there may be some Ukrainian wheat in it, because all these things are global markets now.
Well, that American wheat bread has a good usage. It's good for mopping bars, you know. You clean up...
Well, and it's good for mopping barbecue sauce down to Dreamland in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Stan.
Yeah, well,
you know, when you get your big rack of ribs there at Dreamland, bring you a big plate, a stack of just plain old white bread, and you know, you mop.
Yeah, I was gifted with having we had these rib cook-offs here in Cleveland, and one of the days it was church ladies, you know, and they were mostly non-Caucasian church ladies. And that was the day to go, because you got home-style cooking going on down there. These women were cooking barbecue, and the churches, too. When I worked in the knitting shops, some of the ladies would come in and tell me their church was having a barbecue dinner. Did I want to order one? One, hell, I'll order two right now. Because, man, I don't care what part of the country you're from, you can't beat stuff that's... I had a neighbor lady, a Kentucky lady, whose son I used to taught me how to catch bass. He was a good guy. He was good at teaching me. And he was a Vietnam vet, too. And she would send over biscuits and gravy on a Sunday morning, Bob. And
oh, you're going to hurt me, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going to nail you.
And big old cat heads?
Oh, man. No, there was a black lady that... on the first floor, who could cook southern style catfish cooking, and her and her husband and well, we all was one thing about us. We there was six apartments in the suite. Well, first of all, there were 654 suites, because that was my apartment number, was the last one And the buildings were opened in 37, and Eleanor Roosevelt came in to open them. So it was a funny neighborhood to grow up in, and maybe it was the best. Because at one point in time, after the 56 Hungarian uprising, we had an influx of Hungarian people who, mm-hmm. who had escaped across the border. I don't think most Americans...
And there was an influx after the Prague Spring, too, wasn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. And that whole mess of... you know, it's like we have this one guy here, this one talk show host who made his living as a sports show caller and got into the business. And he's a mildly entertaining guy, but he's standing there one day and said, my father told me the Russian army was worthless. Here's a map. Here's Moscow and Leningrad, and here's Berlin. Tell me how useless they were.
I love that. I love that line in Casablanca when Captain Reynaud looks at the German colonel and says, "Oh, I don't know. I was with those blundering Americans when they blundered into Berlin in 1918."
Yeah. Well, that was a whole story too. There's a tremendous book out on the attacks that were. It was called 1917, the penultimate round. I wish I could get it and send it in and have it put on. If I have one argument with the guys that helped me move, they went into my bookcase and took all the books out. They said, well, what does he need them for? Well, I spend about 4 a year into the site center and they have volunteers who read them. And it's kind of funny sometimes to hear some guys pronounce words, because they're good readers of English, but the pronunciation of different things throws them. But I don't know, sometimes I feel I've been exposed. You know, my mother was cleaning the house on a Saturday afternoon at about 3 o'clock. The news came across about a war starting in a place called Korea. It was Sunday in Korea, of course, you know, that good old international dateline. The international dateline is not something you call on the telephone and listen to somebody talk sensually to you, you know. From another country.
Irish Dave is absolutely irrepressible. He just sent a note in. You'll appreciate this, Bill. He said, we are all Ukrainians now, mein Kamerad.
Yeah.
We will never, right. And then we will never be Hungary again, Scarlett.
Yeah.
You can almost hear Lindsey Graham saying it.
Oh, yeah, he's another one, And McCain is, I don't know, sometimes I think McCain could be fit for a reversible white coat. And of course, didn't he dump his plane in the water one time coming off a carrier?
I think he was almost as good a pilot as George H.W. Bush.
Well, yeah, what helps a lot when you're in the Navy and your grandfather and your father were both admirals, it never does hurt you. See, I don't know what people expect us to do. Maybe they should have lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was, 17, 18 years old when that was going on. And it's a wonder my teeth didn't break. They were chattering pretty good.
I think a lot of people were. I mean, I just, I was pondering that. I guess it was last October, thinking about because I had never considered it before. My mother was smack dab in the middle of her pregnancy with me when that was going on.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, imagine for a moment what it must have been to be
carrying
be 6 months pregnant, wondering if the world was about to get roasted.
Yeah, it could have, too. The estimate in the book, 2 minutes to midnight, was a potential 50 million loss. Of course, it would have that would have pleased some of the rich folk. Isn't there a hotel in West Virginia somewhere where the basement was...
The bunker at the Greenbrier? Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that now, too.
Occasionally I have these little entrepreneurial urges, and I always thought it would be fun to put on a double feature of, or maybe a triple feature, of Failsafe, On the Beach, and... Dr. Strangelove, and show him in the bunker.
Yeah. Well, I know there was a movie about the day after a nuclear war.
Yeah, the day after, 1983.
Yeah, and me and my wisdom, I was trying to get something going with this young woman. I said, well, I'll take her to the movies. Oh, well, so much for that idea. I still laugh at myself. That was a delightful thing to take somebody to see. That was romantic as hell, I'm sure. God. Sometimes I wonder, Bob. Just the idea, though, that I say you guys were Albert is always he's a guy that can wind my clock real good. He can go from making you think seriously one second to falling off the chair the next. Because I wonder where he's been. He has been off the air for a long time, has he not?
He has been. You know, he's got a
self-employment. Yeah.
Well, no, they've got a new little baby boy on the ground and. That takes up a lot of time if you're trying to be a responsible parent.
Well, yeah, don't even talk to me. Mine were divorced when I was 2 years old, and I wonder why I was. The only thing my mother was like Obama's mother, pushing you. Get out there and read that book, you idiot. You'll learn something.
Oh, by the way, speaking of books, a note just came in from Ron in Raleigh, who says, tell Bill he needs to get a copy of The Real McCain by Cliff Schechter.
Well, I hope I can find it. Because you'd be surprised how much stuff never hits the talking book section of the Library. The Library of Congress is given credit for the books. And what I do is the site center has readers if you can send them in, but the only things I've...
Oh, I used to do some volunteer work like that when I was down in Atlanta, yeah.
Well, that's good. I appreciate it, and thank you. I might get to say thank you to somebody, although sometimes... Some of the pronunciations had me wondering, well, I thought I had it wrong. And then you hear some guy pronouncing, especially...
Yeah, and the college that I started at out in Missouri had a really progressive, forward-thinking program for people with learning disabilities like dyslexia when I started there. And one of my first work-study jobs, based on my previous experience, one of my first work-study jobs was to read textbooks onto tape for people with reading-based learning disabilities and sight-based disabilities.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate the hell out of it. But some of the people are.
I know what you mean about being a little perplexed at pronunciations and things, because I remember being assigned to read an algebra text. And they thought they were doing me a favor because I was struggling with algebra. But, I mean, no, I often wonder if I did more harm than good trying to translate that onto tape.
Well, sometimes I wonder, and I went to these parochial schools where they sometimes stuck a coach of a freshman football team into a teaching job. And the one guy taught algebra, and I had struggled with it. And when I was prepping for the... high school equivalency test, I got a book like Algebra Made Simple for Adults, and it fell into place so fast it wasn't funny. Sometimes you wonder if who's doing the teaching is where some of your trouble may lie, because some of them are like everybody else. I've known great car mechanics, and I've known guys that didn't know which end of the wrench was which. That's one point of pride for me when I've had two professional mechanics tell me I might be the best back air guy they ever saw. And he said, well, because you'd sit down and read the goddamn manual. I had fun for a while as a part of your start switch on a GM used to carry a current from the starter section to the shift lever so that it would only start in neutral or park. And there was a big resistor on there, and the resistor went bad, and that 12-volt light told me when you got power to one side and not to the other, well, gee, the resistor must be open. So I put a jumper wire on it, and I put the damn truck in drive when somebody was sitting next to me and just turn the key and off we go. And they'd look at you like, what the hell did you just do? You know me, Bob, I can't resist a good practical joke of any kind. As long as, even if I'm the butt of it, I'll do it. But it just amazes me that what does the country want? What are they talking? They expect us to fight for the Ukraine? Sorry, folks. This This is in 1930.
One of the things I find most fascinating is this allegation that Angry mentioned last night that the guy, I think his last name is Omidyar, who is financing this highfalutin new media empire, that he is also financing the resistance, whatever it is, in Ukraine.
Yeah.
That's real interesting.
Well, and I see the Western European powers want to grab it. They want to grab another piece of... Man, you go into, you go near somebody's backyard, you're just...
Oh, that'd drive the... No, I mean... what are they going to do? Offer EU membership and participation in the euro to Ukraine?
Yeah,
that'd drive the Russians nuts.
Well, also the as I say, that's what you know. When Turkey got into World War One and they closed the Dardanelles, you know, the reason the British kept trying to reopen them was that that was the only. How much? Could
yeah, they were trying to get the Russian warm water navy out into the Mediterranean.
Yep, and well, look at the famous thing that that men did, like Woody Guthrie did it, and his buddy Cisco Houston. They sailed together from Britain to over the top of the world. What did they call that, Bob? The and they were getting dumped in the water left and right by the. German U-boats.
Yeah.
And it was, the water was ice cold. The Murmansk Run.
The Murmansk Run, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was called. And, man, I couldn't, and as I say, Woody Guthrie did it. And, of course, those guys like that, those names like that were like magic bells to me and a lot of other people in the 60s. I told you, I was sitting by the art museum and guy, the manager of this club called La Cobb brings a guy out with the guitar, and we start making noise together, and I asked him what his name was. He said, Arlo Guthrie. I just about fell over, not because of who he was, because he wasn't anybody at that point. You know, he was a great guy and a nice player, but he hadn't made a name for himself in the racket, you know. But his father, holy God, you know. That was the whole thing, like the Butterfield Band, they got a rolling start out of the University of Chicago. And one of the biggest pushers was a Greek kid from Chicago named Nick Gravanites. He wrote that song "Born in Chicago," and he sang with it. I got to get try to find some stuff by a group called the Electric Flag that Michael Bloomfield put together with a big horn section and hard pusher. But Bloomers was he decided he liked that stuff that you use a needle. As I said, I spent time in a room with a friend of mine who borrowed my belt and shot and wanted to try it. And I guess I had either read too much about people like Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday and other people who were greater musicians that I never could dream that well. And it killed them. And it's back around. It's big in Lake County. And I think we had 4 deaths in Cleveland just recently in the Cleveland area due to this shit. And, of course, we know that where does it come from, Bob? What special little thing does it come from chemically?
The opium poppy?
Yep. And where are we now?
Over at Opium Poppy Central?
Yep.
Afghanistan?
Yep. And it's just like coke. When did coke start to really push into the country? When we were involved where?
You mean in our little adventures in the global in the Western Hemispheric South?
Yeah, where it was being processed, and of course you and I can go back to Hammett and such and know that this stuff was around when that stuff was written. He wrote that stuff before 1920, most of it.
Well, look, one of America's most noteworthy justices of the Supreme Court enjoyed a little bit of Peruvian marching powder.
Oh, yeah, who was it?
Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr.
Well, I'll be darned. Yeah, he's a Civil War vet, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I think he was wounded.
And skied on his nostrils.
Yeah, well, that's just like John B. Hood when he took his army north when Sherman was heading for the sea. Sherman took the prime part of that army. That was actually 3 armies that Sherman was using. The Army of the Ohio under Schofield, And Schofield got a big promotion after the Civil War to be head of the Army. You remember the name? You see the movie From Here to Eternity?
Oh, yeah, and the book.
And you know where they were based, don't you? The name of the barracks in Hawaii?
Oh, I can't remember that. No.
Schofield.
Yeah, Schofield.
Yeah, we couldn't stop using Civil War names. Well, look at the first tanks that we put out. There was the Grant and the Lee. One of them had a small gun on the turret and a big gun on the side of the tank in a sponson that they were using. And then, of course, after that came the Stuart, the light cavalry tank, the lightest tank, the ones that we sent to the Philippines, and the Sherman. And then from there on in, it was, what, the Pershing? And, Walton Walker, who was killed in a car accident in Korea, for a while they were producing one here in Cleveland at a plant. It was the Walker Bulldog. Because Walton Walker was a sought-off little guy with the bulldog attitude, you know. And what are we using now? What's the name of the main battle tank that we've been running for years?
The Abrams?
Creighton Abrams, yeah. Creighton Abrams took over from, what's his name, in Vietnam, did he?
From Westmoreland?
Yeah. It's a fraternity. Anyway, I'll let you go, but let's say, and with the economy, there's no easy answers as long as the guys can ship. Because it sounds like I don't like people overseas when I...
No. This isn't about some kind of xenophobia, and I never hear it as such, Bill. This is about understanding that... What? That you can't raise standards of living by driving down standards of compensation.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, if I'm not mistaken, didn't Alexander Hamilton come up with the idea that things should be made here? And I wouldn't call him a leftist or a liberal.
No, I wouldn't even call him a progressive.
No, I mean, but it's such a...
He was a royalist.
Thank you. Anyway, with that, I'll let you go. Hang in there.
I'm certainly going to try. Thank you very much, Bill.
Take care.
Bye. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. And, yes, just a reminder as we run downhill toward the end of the program, we are about $80 away from getting out of the hole that we're in right now, which would be rather important for going forward. PayPal button or traditional mail address would be fine, but we've had a lot of help this evening, and it is very much appreciated. We've had help from Sal and from Horst and from Gary and Karen and from Diane and from Chris, and it is all very, very helpful. And from Greg, thank you all very much. Let's go to the Skype line where Sergi is standing by. Hey, Sergi.
Hello there, Bob. Can you hear me fine?
I got you fine.
All right, well, several notes. Number one, that dude earlier who was talking about the streets used to be filled with bicycles, skateboards, and laughter. They're empty now. I don't know where he lives. It was 50-something today, which is cold by Texas standards. And there were kids out playing in the streets here. What kind of dystopia is he talking about?
Well, but he lives in a place where all the white people are terrified, Sergi, and they can't go out. Children can't go out on their little scooters without being armed to the teeth.
Either that, or he's talking about sprawlburbia, where it's built around just cars, so that people go flying down the streets at such insane. Even neighborhood streets are such insane speeds, the kids are afraid to go out.
Well, Wally and the Beav now have to, they have to take an AR-15 with them when they go over to see Lumpy. Because remember, this is a white wing world that Wayne LaPierre is talking about. I've never seen the numbers, but I can't imagine there's much of a person of color demographic inside the NRA. No. as you know, as has been pointed out on this program in the past, the reason there is some kinds there is some sane gun control in California has to do with the fact that the Black Panthers about scared the piss out of Ronald Reagan.
And, I've learned that from the Horn family commune here, and it's like, wow, I didn't know that. The more you know. Then the second note is in regards to that story yesterday about the upskirt guy. Yeah, there's a lot of very disturbing loopholes in laws dealing with sexual predators.
Along the lines of that upskirt story, which is getting some press and some outrage, there's another similar one just about a week before a decision came out of the Supreme Court of Georgia, which is more understandable, I think, you know, being as how it's Georgia. Reuters reported that the Supreme Court of Georgia held that a man who had been accused of texting an unsolicited picture of his tattooed penis to a married mother of young children did not commit a crime under a Georgia state nudity law.
Okay.
See, now I don't know where the tattoo comes in with this, because I would think that the question would just be, you know, but yeah, that's me and I'm weird.
Well, I think it is worth mentioning, because you have to be crazy to let a tattoo needle go down there. You just
yeah, I know, but you got. Okay, so the guy's a perv, but you have to, I guess, at least admire his fortitude, because yes, tattoos are painful. So here's what he had tattooed on it. Prosecutors said the man texted the picture of his tattooed penis in October 2012 to a woman who then complained to police. According to prosecutors, Warren's, that's the man's name, genitals were tattooed with the phrase, and this is a sit-down tennis ball moment, Sergi. If I suddenly lose you, I'll know you've run screaming out into the street. This is, no, really, strong enough for a man, but made for a woman.
Isn't that the, what deodorant was that?
Secret? Yes.
Yeah, I knew that sounded.
But, I mean, that's a lot of text to get onto one Johnson, Sergi.
Yeah, that's a very disturbing thought. Someone has I'm not going to go there. Careful, Sergi.
Right. See, I mean, there's no right way to do this. But really, I mean, these are separate, but distinctly similar cases being decided by Supreme Courts in Massachusetts and Georgia. What the is going on with, really? I mean, that's what passes for a culture in the United States now. People taking upskirt shots and sending pictures of their tattooed penis.
And I have a third story to add on to this little pile.
Oh, no.
Which is why I mentioned this in the first place, because this is from right here in North Texas. There was a teacher who recently, I forget the exact outcome of the case, but basically he got off case because he was... This teacher repeatedly sexted one of his students who was a minor, and because he never specifically solicited sex from her, it fell under quote-unquote free speech according to Texas state law, and they could not prosecute him. Because he sent all sorts of vile material to this young girl, but because he never specifically requested sex, he didn't violate any Texas law.
Well, see, something similar happened here. You know, with the case in Massachusetts, it was understood as the Supreme Court of Massachusetts telling the Massachusetts legislature, hey, get on this, okay? Well, meanwhile, in the Georgia case... The law had been a law making it illegal why is this deemed legal? You know, freedom, Wolverines. A law that would have made it illegal to text unsolicited photos of your naked, tattooed dingus was rejected by the Freedom Protecting Georgia legislature last year.
Now, that's KI classy.
Yeah, it isn't it? I mean, because we can't have no big government intruding on our fundamental right to text pictures of our junk.
I mean,
you got to wonder how many Republicans in the Georgia legislature would have been exposed to potential criminal penalties had that bill passed.
Precisely, and that's probably also the reason, you know, this there's such a. I mean, this is a loophole you can send a freight train through here in Texas. Yeah. As long as you never specifically request, like, do you want to have sex, then it falls under free speech. I mean, it's silly. But, and see, here's the sad part about it is, if you flash a minor in the physical world here in Texas, oh, that is a crime and you can be charged. But if you do it via electronic communication, I mean, it's ugh.
Well, and I love the way the delightfully demented minds of the Horn family work, Sergi. Ron and Raleigh just dropped a note in saying, I hate myself. Hey, Bob, was the tattoo done in longhand? Oh, he'll be here all week. And meanwhile, Irish Dave notes that in Texas, that gun would have been tatted with Molon Labe. You know, come and get it. Jesus.
Oh. Oh, that's wrong on so many levels. Someone needs to be in the penalty box for that one.
The time out.
Yeah, you know, how Stephanie Miller does, plays the penalty box. But the main thing I wanted to mention, though, is Wendy Davis. March 4th was the primary. Tuesday night was the primary here in Texas, primary day. And I have good news to report.
Yes.
Even though Republicans still got more votes, like, for their candidate, you know, I mean, like, you know, the way primaries work here in Texas is that you cannot cross sides. Like, if you're a Republican and you want to vote in the Democratic primary or vice versa, what you have to do is you have to sign a form that commits you to that party.
Yeah, in other words, Texas still has closed primaries.
Closed primaries, that's the term I was looking for. And so basically, while a lot more people voted in the Republican primaries than in the Democratic, which is, you know, the usual for Texas, their turnout has remained stagnant while the Democratic turnouts are, ouch, oh, that hurt. I just bumped my hand, sorry about that. Because I'm one of those people that talks with my hand.
I understand.
The Republicans' turnout has remained stagnant over past years. Democratic turnout skyrocketed, which is saying something considering the fact that, I mean, when there's a lot of contested races on the Democratic side, it's usually what brings out Democrats. If the races aren't contested, Democrats tend to stay home a lot more. Well, Wendy Davis was a shoo-in. Ray Madrigal stood no chance for the Democratic nomination for governor. And a lot of the down-ticket seats were also either, you know, shoo-ins or just plain uncontested. But even that, Democrats still turned out. And we turned out at a surprisingly and astonishingly high.
You know, I think some of the sleazy things that have been said about her have certainly motivated people to support her. I mean, Greg Abbott is by no means a shoo-in, is he?
No, because, and I'm about to get to this too, because, I mean, you know, because, you know, the thing about Texas is that there's a lot of people who, Texas isn't so much a Republican red state as it is a non-voting state. There's a lot of people who are registered to vote, but they aren't registered with either party or any party, and they just kind of float to the polls, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of a beige state, you know.
Yeah, a beige state, basically. And it's like, it's not necessarily, in fact, there are more registered Democrats here than registered Republicans, even, you know, disregarding all the non-registered people. And, you know, closed the closed primary system, because, you know, they're like, well, we still got more people turning out on our side. Well, yeah, because you have a lot more people who are, you know, marching lockstep with the Republican Party, you know, just on, like, teabag of robots, and it's the same people every year. It's not changing. They're not attracting. And so
must protect freedom. Must protect liberty.
Yeah, sure.
And so, like, basically, you know, not only, you know, did we get a higher turnout, you know, higher rate of Democrats turnout than in past years, with the exception of 2008, because that was, you know, Obama and Hillary were still going at it by the time our primary for the president rolled around. But, you know, 2008 is pretty much an outlier. And so we, you know, it's only March, and we've already got a lot of people excited about this race. And, you know, I was at the, you know, party that they held for the primaries, and I mean the energy there was amazing. And you know,
you got a big old hug from Wendy, didn't you?
Oh yes, and it's like if this was a cartoon, like, I mean, she you know, and she was really, because I met her before the Senate District Hall, she remembered me.
That's the mark of a true politician.
All the people she has met, as she remembered me, she gave me this big hug, and if this was a cartoon, I would have melted into a pile of goo with my eyeballs floating off.
Little old puddle of Sergi Jello.
And it's like the energy's amazing. You know, we got a lot more, a surprisingly high number of people turning out for the primaries, and now it's time, you know, to continue getting, you know, the Democrats that didn't vote excited, and also independents and those, because we're picking off a lot of Republicans, especially ones who are concerned with education, because Wendy has a very pro-education record, while Abbott went on record for cutting public education in this state drastically. And so, like, you know, right now we hold a pretty good chance. I would say about a 65 to 70% chance of getting Wendy Davis as our next governor, electing Wendy Davis as our next governor, because, you know, I can already feel the excitement building, you know.
Well, there's no way that wouldn't be better by a factor of, oh, my God, than Greg Abbott, because he's just a nut.
Yes, he is. And he's Rick Perry, who a lot of Republicans don't even like here. He's Rick Perry without the charisma. So, you know, and he has foot and mouth syndrome. So
I'll be honest, Sergi. I would like to know a little bit more about, I mean, and maybe it's just a Texas thing, that this is what it's like to be a progressive in Texas. I'm a little disturbed by some of her pronouncements about a woman's right to choose, and you know, her apparent okayness with corporal punishment in the school system, stuff like that. That is troubling to my sensibilities, but I also understand that being a progressive in Texas is not necessarily the same as being a progressive in, say, you know, Boston.
Yeah. It's pretty much, I mean, you know, overall she is a, and, you know, and to be honest, I mean, she has to court those people who, you know, care about it, you know, because people care about education, but they also, you know, tend to be the NRA types, and so she has to court some of those, you know, you know how politics is, I don't have to explain it.
No, I get it. Hey, we got to get out of here. I just looked at the time and how it does fly. But it's awful good to talk to you, Sergi, and I hope we will talk soon.
If you're going to be doing a show tomorrow, I'll be on the front porch.
Absolutely. Friday on the front porch tomorrow. You take care, Sergi.
You too.
Bye now. That's Sergi calling from the greater Fort Worth area. Thanks, everybody. We took a big bite out of the hole this evening. We're only $80 away from being to the good. So that means $230 fundraising goal for Friday on the front porch tomorrow. Thank you all very much. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. comes Rick Smith on the horn.